Hello, welcome to Beamcast. This is the September 6th edition of the ShonenBeam.com podcast. My name is Jean.
My name is Drew.
My name is Clint.
And as always, we invite you to join the ShonenBeam social network. We are on Facebook, Twitter, my anime list, IRC, all the details are on the right-sided menu of ShonenBeam.com, so check that out and join us. Let's jump right into the news, because we have some pretty big news right off the bat, as reported by News Paradise, who, first of all, are back. Thank you so much to Heiji-sama for coming back online. Great site to have around. The big news is that Beelzebub, the Shonen Jump action-slash-comedy series, is getting an anime adaptation this January, January 2011. There's been a poster about it in the most recent issue of Shonen Jump. So, guys, your thoughts on Beelzebub getting an anime, Drew?
I think it could work as an adaptation because, like, it's the kind of thing that could just go 12 or 24 episodes and be just, like, an episode comedy shtick thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, as am I. Clint, what do you think about it?
I mean, we've been waiting on this to be announced for quite a while now. We've wanted a Beelzebub anime, so it's really great to see. Hopefully it's one of those that gets licensed, like, really quick and just gets picked up and gets really popular because of the anime.
Certainly hope so. Do either of you feel that it's too soon? Because that was being bounced around a lot, that it's just too soon for an adaptation. Drew, do you think that at all?
It is soon. I think there's enough material, certainly. So long as we don't know the episode count, it could be just 12 episodes. It feels like 24 would be enough, especially by the time the anime gets made.
Yeah. Clint?
I think if they were to end at the original, like the first delinquent arc, that would be a perfect ending spot and run the anime probably about 24 episodes.
Yeah, okay, that could make some sense. All right, other news is that we have a couple of one-shots coming from notable authors. One-shots to be published very soon from both Nobuhito Watsuki of Kenshin fame and Hiromu Arakawa of Fullmetal Alchemist fame, so be on the lookout for those. The premiere issue of Toraburu Darkness will be in Jump Squared Volume 11, which is to be released October 4th. It's the spin-off of the original Toraburu series, the harem romantic comedy, emphasis on comedy. We have some news on cancellations and new series in Shonen Jump. Shonen Shiku, the very, very short-lived, I think it ends on Chapter 15, soccer series, has been canceled in this most recent issue of Shonen Jump. And to take its place will be a new series entitled Enigma by Sakaki Kenji in the next issue, which is issue 41. There's Heiji has posted on News Paradise a preview poster that was in Jump. This art, the artist, Sakaki Kenji, is a former disciple assistant of Akira Amano of Katekyo Hitman Reborn fame. And you could very easily tell that from the preview poster, because there are seven characters, and one of them is a very tiny little... It looks very much like Reborn, or a Butcherman from Dr. Slump, if you're familiar with the reference. This so far looks incredibly generic, but that's, you know, just a preview poster, so I will reserve my judgment until we see further news on that. We would presume that there is to be another cancellation forthcoming next week, because we know that another series is set to debut in the following issue, which is Shinkai Hideo's Light Wing, which is going to be another soccer series, which is pretty bizarre that we have Shonen Shiku being canceled, which is a soccer series, and then two issues later we'll premiere another soccer series. But we'll see how that one pans out. Interestingly enough, the art looks very, very much like the art of Iwashiro Toshiaki of Siren. Looks pretty much identical. It's bizarre. Not the same author, though. News that we picked up from ANN, oddly enough, Hayate no Gotoku, Hayate the Combat Butler, is getting a Taiwanese live-action adaptation. That's really all I have to say about that. That's completely, completely bizarre to me, but there you have it. If you're a big Hayate fan, be on the lookout for Taiwan's gift to you. One Piece, as we keep mentioning, is ever so popular, and One Piece has earned 2.16 billion yen on first week sales of the Strong World DVD and Blu-ray discs from the week of August 23rd through 29th, so reports Oricon rankings. Again, just crazy, crazy sales for everything One Piece. An interesting collaboration, one that I definitely would not have expected, but the author of Moonlight Mile is collaborating with the artist, Yusuke Murata, of iShield 21 to launch a new manga called Dunten Prism Solar Car in the October issue of Jump Squared. It centers around a young man who works at an ironworks factory to save money for college, One day, a group of engineering students visits that the Ironworks storehouse where he lives, and they ask for his technical expertise in building a solar car. So, interesting concept, and a very interesting pairing of author and artist there. This is not shown in news, but it is news of note. Golden Boy 2 is set to debut, or Golden Boy is set to return, what have you, after 13 years away, which will take job-hopping Kintaro to the entertainment world. So be on the lookout for that, because it's a pretty damn funny series. The Oricon rankings for this week, there's really not too much of note, so I'm just going to fly through it here. The top five are We Were There, number 14, Mei-chan no Shitsuji, number 13, Detective Conan, number 69, Fairy Tale, number 22, and Dead Man Wonderland, number 8. Very little in the way of shonen. FMA is still on there, Kakashi's still on there, Hayate, One Piece 59, of course, is still on there. The total sales for that one are over 2.3 million now, but really not too much to expand upon. So we're just going to move straight ahead. Talk about release dates for this upcoming week. No anime of note in the shonen world to talk about, so looking exclusively at manga, we have Volume 20 of Hoshin Engi, Soul Hunter, for $9.99. For those of you that just can't be bothered to read all that darn difficult text in the regular releases of Naruto, you have Naruto Chapter Book 15 for $4.99. Oh My Goddess, Volume 36, is coming out for $11.99. Shaman King, Volume 30, which is surprising me a little bit that they're taking this long to release it, but good that they still are, $9.99 on that one. Tagamibachi, or Letter B, Volume 3 for $9.99. And finally, Volume 2 of Toriko for $9.99. I'm certain we can all recommend that last one. Very happy. The first volume of Toriko didn't come out all of that long ago, so nice release schedule on that one, and certainly a recommended pickup. We're going to move now into our discussion and weekly poll segment. And first, we want to talk briefly about the results of the last week's poll, which, again, was what underlying power system concept is the most interesting. We gave you a whole bunch of different power system concepts, meaning like Devil Fruits, Gourmet Cells, Nen, Stands, Alchemy, whatever the hell you want to call what Law of Ueki introduces to you. Which of those did you find the most interesting? The winner, with 34.5% of the vote, pardon me, is Devil Fruits from One Piece. Followed up by Alchemy from Fullmetal Alchemist with 23.8%. After that is Nen from Hunter x Hunter with 17.9% of the vote. Following that, Stands from JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, 13.1%. Changing A to B from Law of Ueki, 7.1%. And bringing up the rear is Gourmet Cells from Toriko with 3.6%. Thank you very much to everyone who voted in that poll. Certainly seemed to have been an interesting enough poll for a lot of you to have voted, so thank you very much for that. We did ask you, as we ask every week, if you felt like elaborating on your answer, to please email in, shonenbeam@gmail.com. And a couple of you did. So very briefly, I just want to thank you. Hao-sama, for example, voted for Alchemy because of the scientific basis behind it. You actually linked to a rather nice article on another WordPress blog. Thank you very much for that very interesting read. I really looked at the scientific backing of the concept of alchemy as well as I understood it, and seemed to bring the concepts of the element a little bit more into a scientific, realistic sort of sense. So it's certainly a very valid reason for voting for Alchemy over anything else, because certainly the other ones are a little bit more fantastic. They're not as grounded in some semblance of realism. So thank you very much for your email on that. Mario also emailed in saying that he voted for Nen because of its versatility, because of the fact that it has subdivisions. It can be used in so many different ways, offense, defense. It can be used for tricks, for illusions. And Mario was kind enough to provide several examples, which I have forgotten, or I simply don't have the time to go over anyway. But Nen, certainly, quite frankly, that's what I would have voted for if I had a vote in the poll on the site. Very, very versatile. I understand why you could have voted for that. So thank you both of you for your emails. Everyone else, please continue to email in. We'd be happy to hear from you. We have a new discussion this week. The new poll question is, what is your favorite currently running comedy series? And we're narrowing this down, obviously, to the main scope of the primary three shonen magazines, which are Jump, Magazine, and Sunday. So our different options here, bear with me, there are a few of them here, are Beelzebub, Gintama, Hajimete no Aku, Hayate no Gotoku, Onidere, Sayonara Zetsubou-sensei, Sket Dance, The World God Only Knows, and Yankee-kun to Megane-chan. So, Clint, I'm going to turn that over to you first. Let's just discuss amongst ourselves, what do you find to be your favorite currently running comedy series?
It's a really difficult choice. I mean, comedy series, the list we have here is a standout list of really good manga. Like, comedy series, for some reason, tend to be quality manga. So, like, it's a tough choice. But if I had to pick a single one out of the entire group, probably Hayate, most consistently funny as a comedy series.
Okay. Drew, how do you feel about these options? What stands out to you?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's more like the delinquent types of comedy that really stands out. Like, Beelzebub and Yankee-kun would be my top two, but these are, in general, a bunch of really funny series, which is kind of why they're on here. They're running in major magazines. They should be funny, and they, for the most part, are.
Absolutely. Personally, I would have to pick Sket Dance as my overall favorite and probably follow that up with Gintama. So really nice there to see that the three of us have two different selections that are different from the other selections of the other two of us. So quite a few very, very good options, as Clint pointed out. So that poll will be up by the time you hear this podcast. So again, the poll question is, what is your favorite currently running comedy series? Please vote on that. And if you have if you feel that we missed a major series, if you by chance read Coach Akame, for example, please email in, or if you want to expand on why you picked one over another, please email in shonenbeam@gmail.com. It is now time to move to the Great Shonen Tier List segment, which has been seeing a lot more activity and interest. So thank you, everyone who's been following the list, asking us to do various things. From the earlier emailers, actually, Hausama has requested that we tier Father and Pride from Fullmetal Alchemist and Boa Hancock of One Piece. Unfortunately, we got your email a little too late to do them this week, but we will begin to do them starting next week. As a matter of fact, I've been wanting to do Father and Pride and some other FMA characters in past weeks. I just haven't felt that I was sure enough of their abilities. I didn't feel confident enough to do them. I will do the research this week. We'll do at least one of those starting next week, so we will get to those, I promise. Mario, another one of our emailers, had pointed out that our Erza versus Kurama discussion from last week in the tier list could perhaps have been flawed. He wasn't really calling us out on anything particularly, but one interesting point that he made was that when we were talking about the Tree of Forever Illusions, when looking at Kurama's matchup comparison to various other characters, Erza is basically immune to illusions because she has a magical eye that kind of renders her immune to those kinds of things. Having discussed this, we seem to have come to an agreement that a twofold agreement that would keep Erza where she stands in that fight. One of them is that it seems as though the type of illusion that that Kurama would be able to create is more organic. It's not really a purely magical sort of thing. It's very much plant-oriented. So it just feels as though they'd be kind of on different wavelengths, that and then her magical eye.
Kind of see it as he would be targeting a nerve rather than just, like, illusions that you would see with your eyes, illusions that, like, get fed directly to your cerebral cortex.
Absolutely. And then also, Mario had pointed out that we were talking about the different armors that Erza has, the Armadura Fairy armor, the Adamantium armor, and all those different things. And at no point that he could recall, and that similarly for me that I could recall, do we see those major armors of Erza cover her head. So that made us look back at the list to make sure, you know, could any of the characters around her target her head specifically and be victorious? We did have a rather lengthy discussion about whether that would put her below Sani, because Sani would certainly, if they were in close range, Sani would certainly be able to target the head. It just seems that because of Kurama's decided advantage in other areas, probably not even needing to use the Tree of Forever Illusions to get a victory on Erza, because of all the other factors, she wouldn't really go any higher, and yet she still has the ability to fly, and she has an energy attack in form of those magical sabers that she can send out. So just, you know, you bring up a fantastic point regarding her lack of head protection. It just seems that might not be relevant to this particular placement in comparison to the characters above and below her. But still, that will definitely be considered for future tiering should anything be tiered in comparison to her. So excellent point. Thank you very much for the email. One point that we do want to address is that we realized that we have a character tiered completely incorrectly, very much. Asakura Yo of Shaman King, the protagonist of Shaman King, we had him tiered above Gon Freecss, which would make him... He was at the fourth place in the mid-tier. Drew
yeah,
now would like
the,
to explain why
of
that's
this
very
is sort
wrong.
Of on me.
Yeah, that's okay. So
yeah,
why is
I
that
sort
wrong?
Of forgot what happened in the immediate ending of Shaman King, which is that Yo integrates himself with the spirit of Earth, and he gets the ability to cause large-scale earthquakes and also the ability to control gravity up to the extent of counteracting a black hole.
That's a pretty big point of note that you overlooked. That's okay. So controlling gravity certainly is going to move him probably above that tier, I would guess. How far up are we looking?
I'm looking pretty high up. That's like the way he uses it, the way he's able to use gravity control to redirect large scale meteors and like on a black hole scale puts it on my level, like planet level, like around Frieza somewhere.
Okay. So, I mean, if he has control over gravity, I would get the feeling he'd be able to defeat Frieza because he would be able to stop Frieza from flying away and destroying the planet. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I feel like flying is somewhat limited by extremely heavy gravity. We've shown characters in DBZ to be affected by it, so I feel like if Yo just, like, puts up maximum gravity around himself, Frieza still won't be able to defend against that.
Okay. Now, does this technique of Yo's take some time to activate?
No, it's fairly instantaneous. He has the Spirit of Earth, and he just uses it to change gravity.
Okay. Because the feeling that I get is that if a character is so blindingly quick that he would be able to get an instant kill in on Yo before Yo really has a chance to influence the battlefield with this control over gravity, then they would be able to beat Yo. Do you follow that at all? Do you agree with that at all?
Yeah, I can kind of see that. Like, integration is something that does take... It takes kind of a split second, even if it's not quite like... It's not quite instantaneous. I can see what you mean there.
Okay.
That sort of argument of speed does work.
Okay. Well, in that case, would he just be then one notch above Frieza, but then below Hiei, who is a renowned speedster?
Yeah, I could see him getting cut in half by Hiei.
Okay. So that seems easy enough. Fairly clean cut, then. We will move Yo from where he certainly did not belong. So if we've offended any Shaman King fans, we apologize. Not that we heard from any. So we'll put Yo right below Hiei, but above Frieza. But it's now time to introduce a whole bunch of incredibly manly characters. It seems to accidentally be manly week, even considering that we have two cute girls on the list. And first up, certainly very, very manly, Whitebeard, as has been requested. We've received a request to tier Whitebeard, so we figured, he's kind of a boring character, but I guess we'll tier, you know, the closest man to Gold Roger's strength. We're looking high to begin with, wouldn't you say? I mean, just in terms of his mythos within the series, just how incredibly powerful he is. Ultimately, though, I kind of get the feeling he'll be limited by certain factors. One, even though he has the Earthquake Fruit, which is said to be the strongest Paramecia, which is on par with Logia Fruits, it is still a Paramecia fruit. Therefore, he is not able to turn into an element. He's not able to kind of distort his body.
He doesn't have that kind of defense.
Correct. So he's going to be limited by that. He also is limited by the fact that simply we just haven't really seen him at his character strongest. He's always, as we've seen him, and we've seen him freakishly strong, you know, don't get me wrong, but he's always been, you know, hooked up to IVs or limited by certain factors. So I get the feeling he's not going to go quite as highly as perhaps would initially be thought. But let's begin to narrow the playing field a little bit here. And let's start to look in elite tier, see if we make the jump up to top tier or if we actually are okay in elite tier. Let us look, first of all, we just have a whole swath of Bleach characters at the top of the elite tier. Would we all be in agreement that these Bleach characters, let's remove speed from it, are able to kill Whitebeard? Is that at all to be
like
argued?
Concentrated power swords, yeah.
Right. I get that feeling. Clint, do you feel that if they can connect a strike, they can cut him in half and kill him?
Yeah, I mean, I think Reiatsu gives them the ability to do that.
Okay. So speed seems, again, to be a very important deciding factor in all of this. Whitebeard is fast, but he's not Bleach fast, would you say, Clint?
Yeah, he's not quite up to that level of speed.
Mm-hmm. He's fast in man-to-man combat, but he's not eye-blink fast.
And, of course, he can't fly, so that's an added dimension to the fight there. So we're looking... are we in agreement we're looking below the Bleach characters?
Yeah.
Okay. In that case, let's actually jump down to the bottom of this tier and just make sure that we're looking in the right space here. It seems to me that just pure, unadulterated strength alone, he's able to defeat Jiraiya, Orochimaru, Devilman... that trio right there, it seems like no contest. Whitebeard can create earthquakes in the air, even. So he can send shockwaves of earthquake-type energy through the air to destroy them. And if he gets close, of course, he has the most colossal strength that we've seen in One Piece. So
If you're talking there? About shockwaves, like, yeah, it's a, shockwaves are a pretty powerful defense on a molecular level.
Right. One above Devilman is Hitsugaya from Bleach. I don't really get the feeling. He is a Bleach character. He is exceedingly quick. I just don't think he can actually kill Whitebeard. Clint, what do you think about that one?
I mean, he's a little weaker than some than certainly the other Bleach characters we have tiered higher than him. And all his ice techniques are kind of... I don't feel like Whitebeard would be trapped by that. I mean, we've seen characters in Universe break out of the ice and be fine.
Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, what it feels like is just that, like, Whitebeard would be able to shake the air around him and, like, break out of any ice that got him trapped.
That's a very good point. One above that is Frederica of Siren, and she's actually an interesting matchup issue because we see Whitebeard put out Akainu's sort of like molten lava flame, which I guess canonically lava is greater than fire at being heat. I'm still trying to come to terms with that entire concept. That was an interesting one, Oda. So he puts it out with a puff of air. He just kind of blows on it and defeats it. So if he can do that, what's he going to do to Frederica? I mean, that, or I suppose conversely, what could
Frederica's
Frederica possibly
not
do?
Much to him. She is a pyrokinetic, and that's it. So if she can't use fire, if that doesn't work, then she's out.
Right. All right, Yusuke, in character, Yu Hakusho. He is very much a reinforced type of strength and beam spam and great durability. But what's he going to do to Whitebeard exactly? He's not exactly exceedingly quick. I mean, he's fast for a delinquent human, but he's not a super speedster, not like Hiei, not like a Bleach character. Durable, but I'd be more than willing to say that if Whitebeard gets a hit and it's over. And then the beams, do you think that they're going to take out Whitebeard?
Yeah.
Clint? Drew?
Whitebeard got half his face blasted off and still, like, punched a guy out in two hits. I don't get the feeling that, like, just spirit guns are going to do it.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Clint?
I certainly think that he can weather through them by, like, using the earthquakes through the air to weaken the spirit blasts.
Mm. Yeah, that would make sense, too. Yeah, and you're absolutely right, Drew. The fact that he got his face blown half off, the amount of damage he can take, it seems as though he's going to take some pretty serious hits from whoever he faces and still be able to fight at pretty much near full power. So let's look now at the two Naruto characters that we have back-to-back. And again, to refresh your memory for Naruto specifically, Naruto the character specifically, this is Naruto before he has the Yellow Flash. And we have not yet retiered Naruto to include the Yellow Flash that he gets because we simply haven't seen him exhibit any kind of mastery over that. So we're going to save that until he's shown to use it properly. So this is the Naruto who uses the Gargantuan Rasengan, is reinforced by all the chakra of the fox. So comparing Naruto, Gargantuan Rasengan, all that I just said, versus Whitebeard, then it does seem as though those massive scale energy type of attacks are going to create some serious problems for Whitebeard, at least to me. But what do you think, Drew?
I think to me, like, as much as Whitebeard has the power to shake the air, he doesn't have the power to fully disrupt the Rasengan, which is just like a swirling mass of chaos. And I feel like that is the type of attack that would actually mess him up if it got to him.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about this, Clint?
Beyond the regular Rasengan or the Gargantuan Rasengan, I mean, he has the Rasen Shuriken, which causes damage at a cell level, a cellular level. And I think that would definitely seriously hurt Whitebeard if it were to connect. And I think with the clones and all of his techniques, Naruto has the ability to connect with that kind of thing.
Okay. I happen to agree with that. So that would put Whitebeard below Naruto and above Yusuke. But before we move on from him, I'm going to bring up an interesting point. We have Eneru of One Piece also tiered in top tier. I don't think any of us are suggesting that Whitebeard is weaker than Eneru in series, are we?
No.
Okay, I just wanted to get that straight. In series strength level comparisons and things like that are being taken out of the equation for the purposes of this tier list. So before, you know, if you have an argument and you feel it's a legitimate argument, of course we'd be more than happy to hear from you. ShonenBeam@gmail.com. Please reach us and let us know what you think. But before you write in with your hate mail saying, how could you possibly put Whitebeard that far below Eneru? He would destroy Eneru. Yes, he would. But we're not looking just specifically at in-universe comparison tiering. We're looking at overall skill set and then placing it very, very objectively on a neutral battleground. So we are of the opinion that this makes more sense in terms of the tier list. But of course, in series, Whitebeard would have wiped the floor with Anandru. That's not even questionable. Let us move on now to a character who has seen some very, very strong exposure in the last few weeks. Hoshigaki Kisame from Naruto has just finished up his fight with Gai. Didn't go so well. but let's see where we can place him on the tier list here. Let's look down a little bit. Since he fought Gai, let's look around Gai, but not necessarily against him first. I mean, certainly if it came down to a tiebreaker, you know, spoiler, as the rest of the segment is a spoiler-filled segment, you know, Gai wins. So if it's just a tiebreaker, we put him below Gai. But let's look elsewhere. Another Naruto character, there's a couple more actually, Tsunade, is above Gai. Do we have any reason to believe that Kisame would stand a chance against Tsunade, Clint?
I don't think so. Tsunade is... She gets overshadowed by Jiraiya and Orochimaru, but she still is one of the Sannin. She's one of the legendary three ninjas. She's stupidly strong. She's capable. She has the...
She has infinite
the slug
regeneration.
Summons. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense to me as well. Now, the other in-series opponent for Kisame would be Gaara, who's a few notches down from Gai. And Drew, what are your thoughts on that one? Would Kisame have enough strength, techniques, or just circumstantial, just the circumstantial situation to be able to deal with Gaara of Sand?
I feel like beyond being able to summon sharks, I feel like the other big thing that tips the match in Kisame's favor is the fact that his sword eats chakra or energy.
Mm-hmm.
And like one of Gaara's biggest strengths is that he's got like the chakra power. The chakra powers is sand, and he has like large reserves of it.
Right.
But like we've also seen that his sword concealed Naruto's chakra on that level. So I don't think that Gaara's going to have enough energy to fight that absorption.
Okay, so he's somewhere in between those two Naruto characters. Now regarding Crocodile, first of all, from One Piece. Sand Logia user versus Kisame, who can summon water. And, you know, often in other times, for example, when we tried to tier Lucy Heartfelia of Fairy Tail, we couldn't put Aquarius in there because we're assuming that this is on a dry battleground. We're not assuming that just for convenience's sake there happens to be an ocean. In this circumstance, though, Kisame actually can summon large amounts of water. Would that play very largely into the fight, or do you feel that the tide would turn in one favor or the other for other reasons? Clint, how do you feel this would go?
I think with especially the water prison technique and the scale that Kisame has used that on before, I don't know that Crocodile stands a chance here. He's almost certainly going to get wet and not be able to use that major defense power of the Logia, which is to separate and use that as defense.
Right.
I think Kisame has a lot of durability, and Crocodile's doesn't have that once he's stripped of his sand evasive Logia power.
That makes sense to me. So looking again one notch above that is Natsu Dragneel, the main character of Fairy Tail, who is fire. So you might immediately think, well, it's over just because he's fire. But he is magic fire, and Drew, you had an interesting point to make about that.
The fact that fire can be like, when you use fire to defend against water, it'll just become steam, so theoretically that'll neutralize some of the attacks coming at him. And if it's just steam, he's relatively immune to heat.
Mm-hmm. That said, though, we've mentioned Samehada a couple times, Kisame's sword. Samehada being able to suck up chakra energy, what have you, versus Natsu, who is pretty much an endless source of such energy. If all of that energy is just being sucked away, is Natsu really going to be able to do anything? What do you think, Clint?
I don't think so. I think those characters like Natsu, like Naruto, who are just an endless well of like whatever energy the series holds as its standard, they're a terrible matchup against Samehada.
Mm-hmm. That would end up placing him below Gai. Do you have any final thoughts on Kisame versus Natsu then, Drew?
Yeah, I think that pretty much is what it comes down to. Like, a sword that eats energy versus someone who relies on lots of energy for his attacks, it's pretty clear who's going to win that one.
Okay, so ultimately it does come down to just placing him one below Gai, but we tried. all right, rounding out the big three, Siren. and Amamiya Sakurako, who really had a very nice spotlight chapter, chapter 132. She finally got to stand out as we reveal her Nova, so what better time than now to add her to the tier list? So now she has. Could you kind of briefly summarize what her newfound abilities are, and maybe a couple of her older ones, Drew?
She can. her older abilities were that she had sort of like psychic control. She could give people hallucinations. She had limited amounts of enhanced physical strength. Her new form is that she can sort of split into two personas of herself. Like once she activates her Nova power, she effectively instantaneously splits into a bunch of dust that coagulates into two parts and also spreads over the battlefield. The end result is that she can read minds and she's got a very quick reaction speed. She can take at least one hit against anybody due to the splitting thing.
Right. Just the free hit. I mean, even nothing else. Just the free hit would put her pretty highly. But obviously, the capability to read minds. She also has what is that insanity attack? I can't recall the name of that one.
Insanity Scythe.
Yes, thank you. Where she can kind of create madness within the her target, thanks to her scythe. We're looking pretty highly here, in my opinion. I'm actually going to start at the bottom of top tier. Just to see. Kisuke, Urahara Kisuke of Bleach, is right now the bottom of top tier. Drew, your opinions on just how that fight might play out?
Well, we've got two characters against whom which you really have, like, the one free hit. Urahara has the good guy, and then Amamiya has, like, the splitting. But beyond that, I feel like her having the ability to read his mind, plus her being able to attack in, like, really, really fast speed, if not like instantaneous Bleach speed, at least being able to attack very fast. Like, I feel like she has an edge in that, tactically.
Yeah, particularly because of her ability to read minds. I would be of the opinion to put her above Kisuke. Clint, you know a decent amount about Bleach. Are you okay with that?
Yeah, seems fine to me. I mean, it's a character with a much wider scope of powers than you would see in Bleach.
Okay. That would next put her up against Eneru of One Piece, obviously the Logia of Electricity, or of Thunder. So how do you feel, Clint, about how that fight could possibly play out? Again, I know that you don't read Siren, but you kind of have a decent understanding of those powers, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, if Eneru could be affected by the illusions, I'm not sure how he would deal with that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting. A lot of his key is speed and you know, the fact that he's somewhat immaterial, but I get the feeling, and Drew, back me up on this if you agree, that she'd be able to strike him because of her specific sword. Do you agree with that?
I feel like the psychic attacks she has are at least equivalent to Haki in terms of being able to strike Logia users.
Mm-hmm. And as we read when we were doing our research for this, her sword was created by Anne Psychicker. So it is actually...
pretty powerful stuff we're talking about.
Yeah, it's not just a Psychicker, it's Anne Psychicker. even if she doesn't need to rely on whatever the equivalent of Haki is to be able to strike a Logia user, which I think she would have, but even if she doesn't need that, she has a sword, which is kind of like an enchanted sword. So I just get the feeling that she could strike him. And if she's able to connect with a Logia user, then, you know, the free hit, the mind reading, I mean, Eneru would have no advantage on Mantra because she has effectively the same thing, if not outright better. So I'm
There are two of her, so it'd be like, arguably it'd be harder for one person who can read minds against two who can read minds.
Right. Great point. So then let's look above Eneru at Medusa from Soul Eater. And this is more your area of expertise, Clint. Duplicates, reading minds, and all that. But what could she actually do offensively against Medusa, if anything?
Well, first of all, the mind reading is something she wouldn't want to do against Medusa. If she tried that, that's kind of where Soul Eater's the madness, the insanity would come into effect. Mm-hmm. I don't think reading Medusa's mind would be a very good experience for anyone.
Plus, in order to do that, she needs to have the dust scattered, and in order to do that, she needs to get past Vector Stream.
Which, does she have anything that would enable her to do that? I don't think so.
No.
Okay, so is this pretty handily in favor of Medusa then?
I would say so.
Okay, and assuming that's not just a tiebreaker issue, does Amamiya stand any chance against Hyobu, Negi, Jotaro? I don't feel that she does, Drew.
No, I feel like she's like below that tier of psychic.
Okay, so I'm going to place Amamiya right below Medusa. Nice to have another Siren character on there. It's about time. Let's introduce another underappreciated series, reintroduce, I should say, Nogami Aoi of Zettai Kaden Children. It's been a while since we've put, I think it was since the first show when we did this, since we put a ZKC character on there. So this is very much your area of expertise, Drew. So a brief synopsis of her powers and then where you're approximately looking to start tiering.
Essentially, she has the same ability of teleportation as Hyobu, actually a notch above. She doesn't have psychokinetic powers or anything else, so... But I feel like we're not looking too far above Hyobu, because still with the speed advantage and the fact that she can teleport other people and heavy objects and fly, I feel like we're looking at a very similar ability to Hyobu's, a bit inferior in terms of like the peripherals that she can also use.
Okay.
So I feel like we're looking like one or two notches maybe below.
Okay. Well, we just placed Amamiya. She's fresh in our minds. So let's compare those briefly then. How do you feel that fight would play out?
I feel like Aoi, like as much as she could teleport, I don't feel like the dust form that Amamiya is in would be like necessarily damaged by being stuck within an object like she could do offensively, or just by having an object dropped on it. Mm-hmm. I feel like Amamiya has more of a method of attack, plus she beat a teleporter like this most recent chapter.
That's a very good point, yeah. So looking then at Eneru, teleportation, Hyobu is above Eneru for his wide array of teleporting abilities, but he also has the psychokinesis, as you mentioned, which can cause, he can cause brain hemorrhages, aneurysms, heart failure, things like that from a distance. Aoi doesn't have any of that. Does she have an answer for Eneru?
I don't really think so. I feel like she is faster, but she's just going to eventually get overwhelmed by some sort of area attack.
Okay. And then Kisuke from Bleach. Now, to me, that's when the teleportation, even if it is, even if she overall is slightly inferior to Hyobu, she still can teleport herself and others. Speed, to me, there's relative amounts of speed, and certainly Bleach speed is way, way up there, but up against instantaneous teleportation, it seems to me that Aoi then has the edge. Your thoughts then, go ahead.
It feels that way, pretty much. Also, the fact that like teleportation gives you a sort of like sixth sense perception of everything that's happening around you. It would sort of nullify like the dummy body he would use to get a free hit.
Right. Clint, I know you don't read ZKC, but do you have thoughts on that one?
Yeah, I don't think Urahara can do much against being like teleported like into a wall or something like that. That doesn't seem something that he could deal with.
Okay. Seems like something I want to read. Alright, let's introduce another manly man. Those two cute girls, they were just, they're breaking up our little theme here. So, Saito Hajime of Rurouni Kenshin. Sadly, we're not looking exactly in the same tier area as we have for the last few characters here, so let's begin to look quite far down the list. Not to the very bottom, but at our general swords person area, at the bottom to middle of fair tier. And immediately, what jumps out at me, Clint, the two Kenshin characters that are already on here, Kenshin himself and Shishio. Your thoughts on comparative strength between those?
Kenshin, I certainly think, is stronger than Saito. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. The Amakakuru Ryu no Hiromeki long name is a pretty powerful technique in universe.
Right. What about Shishio, then, though?
I think that's a more interesting matchup. We did see Saito lose against Shishio, but it was very, very situational. He had had his legs wounded in his previous fight, and his legs are the basis for his techniques. And we also saw him attack the only part of Shishio's body that's armored. So to say that he loses to Shishio is a bit of a stretch, maybe.
Hmm. So could that perhaps then be an issue of a tiebreaker?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so let's look around Shishio to begin with. The two characters right above Shishio are two One Piece characters, Sanji and Frankie. Saito, he's a very skilled swordsman, but still very much within the realm of the realistic. Does he have any answer for Sanji, who consistently fights a swordsman who I think we'd all say is stronger than Saito, or Frankie, who's a cyborg and can definitely fight from a distance?
Yeah, I definitely don't think he has an answer for the distance techniques that Frankie can pull, and I don't think he's as good of a swordsman as Kenshin that he could deal with Sanji.
Mm-hmm. So then looking below Shishio, we have Gintoki and Chopper. Chopper first. It seems to me like Chopper would basically have to go defense point to survive, and then what can he really do? Do you agree with that? How do you see that one, Clint?
Yeah, I think Chopper goes Defense Point to not get one hit killed by Saito's techniques, and from there he can't really do anything. Eventually he's going to have to change forms if he wants to win the fight. And when he does, Saito has that incredibly strong, like, the piercing technique, the Zero Shiki that he could be right next to Chopper with when he uses.
Yeah. So then it seems like we're centered around Shishio and Gintoki. Shishio being a tiebreaker issue, so let's look at Gintoki. Gintoki's strength is a little bit difficult to put your finger on, simply because you get a very limited view of when he's at his most serious as a swordsman. But that could also play out in his favor, because then he also benefits from just the comical strength and durability of a gag hero that an ordinary samurai or just swordsman would not ordinarily have. That said, I will say that, being the only one of us, unfortunately, who's read all of Gintama, I will say that Gintoki seems to me to be, and this is very difficult to quantify with any real evidence, but it's just a gut feeling. I feel that Gintoki is slightly better of a swordsman than Saito is. I know, like, Drew, you've read a little bit of Gintama. I'm not sure how much you've gotten into the serious arcs where you really see his sword skill come into play, but do you have any thoughts on this entire argument at all?
Gintoki does seem to have sort of, like, a freakish, like, sort of beyond just, like, anything a human could reasonably manage strength.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it would go to him, but that's just my own gut feeling.
One thing that I will say is that he has ridiculous durability. He can take so much punishment and just continue to fight at nearly full strength. Whereas I'm not so sure what Saito would be able to do if those kinds of tables were turned against him. Again, I know that you don't read Gintama, but do you have any particular thoughts on this one, Clint?
Yeah, I think Saito's major failing in this fight is that I don't think Gintoki's going to be taken down by one technique. He's simply not the kind of character that would happen to. Certainly he can't survive a pierce through the heart or something, but he's skilled enough to where he could take Saito's stab through the shoulder, and I don't think a stab to the shoulder is going to put Gintoki out. He's not that kind of character.
Mm-hmm. So that would place him below Gintoki, and then would you be satisfied with what that then does also by putting him two spaces below Shishio?
Yeah, I mean, I think in an outright fight, to be in all fairness, he wins against Shishio, but canonically Shishio won. So,
right.
Viewing that as a tiebreaker and then going below Gintoki, which is perfectly reasonable, seems to fit.
Okay. Let us finish out this week with the manliest of all men to end Man Week, Kenshiro of Fist of the North Star. It's about damn time we get him tiered. It's about damn time that I finish the series. since this is a series that is not entirely translated, there's a big gap in the scans. This is obviously the Great Shonen Tier List segment. It is always spoiler-intensive, but I will reiterate that to you. If you have not yet finished this series, I would implore you to fast-forward to our fantastic coverage of recent anime and manga a little bit later on in the show, because you would not want to be spoiled on what happens near the end of this series. Certainly, it is pretty common knowledge to everyone, the basis of what Kenshiro can do. Strike at pressure points, you know, you are already dead, you know, press the pressure points on people and they explode. That would certainly put him fairly strong. Really, though, and what I was unfamiliar with until completing the series, Musou Tensei is kind of his end-all and be-all, and the reason why he is considered so overwhelmingly strong. Musou Tensei is a technique without any particularly limiting factors that allows him to selectively become intangible. So he is able to choose not to be. He can pass through matter, and then anything he passes through he can disrupt and or destroy. So he can do that as simply as just like a karate-style chop, and he is shown to chop at another martial arts user's hands, and those hands are then disabled. He is also, at one other instance, shown to just walk through another person. So very much a sense of bending space around him, completely becoming immaterial, and at that point I feel that he moves quite high up the list. I'm looking at top tier. And let's look at the bottom of top tier, and just as a group. And I'll ask both of you, but I suppose, Drew, I'll ask you first. Looking at Kisuke, Aoi, Eneru, Amamiya, that's a good foursome. Do you feel that they could do anything to the intangible?
I feel like they're attacks that are dependent on some sort of tangible target. If there's nothing there, there's nothing to hit for them. Mm-hmm. They don't warp reality in any particular way.
Right. And it should be pointed out, since a couple of those characters can fly, Kenshiro is not limited to close combat, as might originally have been thought. He does have very, very potent and powerful distance projectile attacks, projectile attacks. So looking, then, the next two above that are Medusa and Hyobu, and those are a little bit different. So Medusa, I'll pose this one to you, Clint. How do you feel about that? The intangible versus versus magic and the ability to change vectors.
Well, basically, I don't feel that the vectors will come into play against an intangible enemy. I think he'll just be able to walk through vector shield, and we've been shown that he can deal damage just by passing through someone, so I don't think Medusa would be able to do anything, really.
Okay. And then, similarly to you, Drew, Hyobu, what can he do against nothing, effectively?
I mean, he can run away, but he needs to have an effective way to take out something intangible. And if he can't teleport him because he's not there, and I get the feeling you actually need to be there physically in order to be teleported in ZKC physics. So I just don't know if he'd be able to make contact. And so ultimately, like, he'd be running away, but eventually he'd just get hit.
Right. Because again, Kenshiro is able to use distance attacks, which certainly would strike. Should they make contact, they would actually hit and hurt Hyobu. Now we're getting into a different kind of magic from Medusa magic in Negi Springfield. This is very much the magic, like fantasy style magic, where magic kind of breaks every and all convention. And also, I believe, Clint, does Negi not also have a similar ability to somewhat become intangible?
Yeah, he can, like Enidu, he can turn into lightning, but it's a different kind of lightning. It's not electricity. It's not a physical, like, elemental thing. It's very much just pure magical energy shaped as electricity.
Okay. And the way that we've been doing all these different relative senses of in-series powers, magic, to me at least, and I hope you both agree with this, is kind of the top tier of the different styles. Because, you know, you have physics, you have ki, chakra, etc. You have certain other kinds of magic, like the fairy tale magic, which seems to be on a different level because it's more elemental-based. But, I mean, this kind of Negima magic is very much just fantasy-style breaking all conventions, just making up anything that you want and justifying it because, quote-unquote, it's magic. So would Negi then have the edge? Because if they're both intangible, he would still have magic attacks, which, again, if magic can do anything, it would be able to strike the intangible, would it not, Drew?
I can definitely see magic being able to hit the intangible. I'm not so sure about ki being able to hit raw magical energy.
Okay. Let's just double check to see if that is a tiebreaker issue, magic versus the intangible. Would you feel that Kenshiro has any chance against our top three, which seem pretty solidly in place there? Do you think he has anything against Jack Rackham and his just colossal magic, Clint?
No, I think turning intangible and the key strikes are all just kind of, they're kind of useless against Jack Rackham. I mean, I don't know that he can really harm him. That's our major argument with Jack Rackham. What can you do to kill Jack Rackham? And almost anyone's answer is going to be nothing.
Yeah, including Jack Rackham's answer. Goku and Cell, they're interesting scenarios, but your thoughts, Drew?
I think Cell he definitely loses to, because, like, as much as he's going to, like, destroy and mess up Cell's body, he's going to need to eradicate him from every cell. And I don't get the feeling he has that kind of destroying ability. Goku is a bit more interesting, but I feel like Goku just has, like, the instant transmission and would, like, he would go very quickly. So it's a question of speed. Even if Kenshiro is, like, able to get up Musou Tensei, like, Goku would be able to effectively move around with that.
Okay. And apparently, a heated debate, a heated point of argument, Jotaro versus Kenshiro. I believe I saw actually Dio versus Kenshiro, but it's a very, very similar set of skills. The ability to stop time versus the ability to become immaterial. Assuming that, and as far as I interpreted it, having just read the series, I don't believe that Musou Tensei requires, you know, time to start up or anything like that. It's a technique that he chooses to use, and it's just on. So assuming that that doesn't require time to be perpetually moving for it to work, and I don't see why it would, if Jotaro stopped time, he, being Kenshiro, would still be intangible and not able to be struck by Star Platinum. And even if he was tangible for some reason, would Star Platinum kill Kenshiro? Kenshiro is renowned for durability, physical strength and durability. Either of you, Clint, you first, do you think that Jotaro would be able to beat Kenshiro?
I think he has a definite argument for it. I do think that Kenshiro would be able to become intangible, but I think that the stand, Star Platinum itself, is something that is intangible. I mean, you can't see stands if you don't have a stand. They are a manifestation of the human spirit. I think that's kind of what Kenshiro's turning into, is pure like spirit or ki or whatever. If anything could connect with that, it would be another being of the same type of makeup.
Okay. I think you just broke the news that Kenshiro is a stand. Great.
Is he listening?
Yes. Drew, do you feel about the same way?
Yeah, I kind of feel the same way Clint does.
Okay. So it seems to me, then, that we're placing Kenshiro above Hyobu but below Negi. In agreement on that?
Yeah. That feels right.
Okay, great. Certainly, that's a lot of characters that people feel very, very strongly about. We don't claim to be experts on all this. We try our best. We do our research. If you have points to make, again, please feel free to email in. If you have points of contention, you feel that we did something wrong, you want to back up our argument even, which I don't anticipate getting emails for that, please email us, shonenbeam@gmail.com. You can also request us to tier certain characters. You know, any and all involvement that you can bring to this activity would be more than welcome. It is now time to move to the anime discussion segment of the show, and Drew is going to begin by looking at Episode 9 of High School of the Dead.
And this episode is pretty much exactly what the preview said. It was the episode where he's alone with the sword girl, and they do a lot of work surviving. Eventually, they get to a temple after like a whole lot of zombie fighting. They go over what her past was. Like, her backstory is that she like assaulted somebody in self-defense, but really enjoyed actually hurting him. So she feels like she's a bit abnormal, but then he manages to convince her through a very weird scene that, like, she's necessary and she should stay with him. Well, there were two weird things that happened. The first one was, like, the implied bow chicka wow wow that happened, like, the night they spent at the temple. The other thing was, like, she's about to go and just, like, fight zombies until she dies, and he grabs her to stop her by the boob.
Yeah, that scene is it's manga faithful. He's making a speech about why she shouldn't die while groping her for no particular reason other than fan service, I would say.
Yeah, that was odd, but it's sort of not unexpected from this show. A whole lot notable other than that.
Well, then we shall move on. Sei Tokai Yakuindemo episode 10, Clint.
Yet another show with a lot of implied bow chicka wow wow, but implied through making terrible, terrible puns on words. This episode was mostly the cultural festival taking place, and our main character being completely worn out by it. At the end, he pretty much falls asleep. But the cultural festival itself was a pretty interesting read, and watching the characters make the jokes they always normally do. Of particular note was that we got to see the household of R.O. Josama of the student council, and meet her maid, which was a new character added to the series.
And predictably also perverted.
Yeah, she's kind of obsessed with smelling used clothing.
You know, I don't watch this show, but just listening you guys week after week discuss the show, it just sounds like you guys are watching softcore together.
You think we're not?
Okay, fair enough.
Just like in separate states right now. Dude, two more weeks and it's on.
All right. Anything else from that show, Clint?
Not really, besides panty sniffing jokes. That's about it.
We could go on for hours, but for the sake of time, let us move on. Drew has episode 10 of Legend of the Legendary Heroes.
This episode picks up where the last one left off, where we see Reiner still in berserk mode, and Ferris eventually like calms him down by predictably lowering her defenses and giving him a chance to kill her, which he then resists and doesn't take. So she closes his eyes, and that's the end of the Alpha Stigma. Then after that, we sort of pop to like back to where Shion is, and we see that, like, Noah and the general who captured her have sort of started a relationship, which is a little weird. Weirder was the fact that a couple people tried to take Noah hostage, which may or may not be a ploy by Miron to get Shion to finally do something about purging the nobles who are against him. But either way, it seems like she now has a psychic link with him. That part was weird. She was abducted, taken hostage. He was on a carriage on the way home, and he just heard her voice, seemingly inside of her head. I'm not sure what's up with that, if it's like a lover's communication or something I skipped over. But that was just an odd episode, and I'm a little uncomfortable with these implications it had.
Okay, well, let's move to something hopefully slightly more comfortable. Nurarihyon no Mago Episode 9, which at the beginning saw the conclusion of the face-off between Rikuo and Gyuki, which ended with Night Form Rikuo taking out Gyuki, but then granting amnesty, not killing him off, and saying, you know, you're still a welcome part of this family, you're still a vital part of our clan. And then eventually the episode transitioned into the general meeting, where finally the day form of Rikuo has taken responsibility for the role that he has in this family, and becomes quite serious at the meeting and fully intends, announces his intention to take over as the third heir, the impending third heir, and announces to everyone that Gyuki will not face punishment, that all responsibility is to fall on Rikuo himself. So kind of nicely rounding out the arc there. There was a little bit of conflict in the meeting from the Cyclops fellow, whose name I don't think has ever been mentioned.
Itosume.
Thank you very much. You know your Cyclops is Cyclopi?
I think it was like the name of a Yu-Gi-Oh card a while back. That's why,
yes,
I remember.
So there was a little bit of conflict introduced by him, who was he was certainly not satisfied with Rikuo being the third heir. But aside from that, it was more or less a straightforward episode where everything seems to be resolved, and it seems like we're going to move forward next episode with a new arc. So, Clint, your thoughts on this episode as a whole?
I think it was a nice ending to the arc. Definitely seeing, like, this arc was had the purpose of legitimizing Rikuo as the third heir, and, like, noting why the other yokai look up to him. But I am ready to move on to the next arc.
Mm-hmm. Drew, what did you think of this episode?
I thought it was interesting. It felt, it kind of made sense, the reason why he granted amnesty to Gyuki, but it still felt a little weak for, like, the sort of Yakuza overtones the Nura clan has been putting on to just, like, allow him to take no punishment at all. I was kind of expecting him to at least, like, take some physical pain for it. I was a little bit disappointed in that. It felt a little bit cliche, but mm-hmm. It was overall a good episode for atmosphere.
I did find interesting the what was being introduced, the concept that Mount Nejireme, which was the territory of the Gyuki clan, the sub-clan of the overall Nura clan, that kind of being the western border of the entire area of influence of the Nura clan, and everything beyond that is outside of that sphere of influence. Kind of, they seem to be starting to set up the rest of the world, as though either they're going to have to fend off hordes of invading yokai, or perhaps venture out and gain more territory, something like that. I mean, that's what I took away from the brief mentions of it. There were a couple different times it was mentioned. Clint, did you take it that way at all? And if so, did you find that enjoyable?
Yeah, I think it's foreshadowing future developments, possibly, and just kind of a way to clue us in, like, hey, there are other yokai out there. Not everyone belongs to the Nura clan. We do have, like, a set territory.
Right. And Drew, what did you think about that, kind of trying to set up the world?
I thought it was, I guess, interesting and, like I said, made sense the way they did it. It felt like sort of a cheap way to avoid punishment for Gyuki at the time he was saying it.
Okay. All right, well, that concludes the anime discussion portion of the program, and it is now time to move to This Week in Manga, and this week we have a monthly release, Mirai Nikki Chapter 55, so Drew, if you could get us started on that, please.
Well, we see the ninth show up. It's revealed that Deus, like, while dying, transferred half of his power to her, and she can now time warp. So while Yuno goes back to, like, elementary school era to find another Yukiteru to presumably molest, Yukiteru and the ninth go back in time as well, so she's also going to go broken there. And he eventually, like, goes to Yuno's house 2 years ago and, like, calls an ambulance to protect her from the cage. And then present day, like, God Yuno shows up having his parents hostage. And that's where the chapter ends.
Clint, your feelings on this chapter?
Is there anyone in the series at this point that can't warp around in time however they want?
Well, I think it's just the two of them so far, but that's kind of too many.
Well, if you count the other versions of Yuno.
Oh, and there are how many now?
I'm not even sure. Does anyone keep count?
A little odd. I think it devalues the ninth as a character a little bit, that she's now got these god powers. It feels like sort of a... It feels like more of a Shyamalan twist this chapter.
Yeah, that was disappointing in the ninth as a character. She was a good character before, just like the explosion crazy, just crazy woman.
Yeah, just explosions and lots of them. But, like, I'm interested to see how Yukitaro reacts to his parents taking hostage. I think, depending on how he reacts, we'll know how he's actually grown as a character. Do you think so?
Yeah, if at all. I mean, we've seen him continue to make mistakes, basically up to the current chapters.
Yeah, I can see that. I'm not too optimistic for what's going to happen next here.
Well, I'm optimistic for what's going to happen next on the show. We're going to talk about Naruto Chapter 408. We're into our weekly series discussions, and we begin here with a swift biology lesson. We are humans, not fish. Thank you very much for educational. This is my favorite educational series out there. This is the end of the entire Guy and Kisame fight, as we mentioned earlier in the Great Shonen Tier List segment of the show. And we get to see, first of all, I thought it was a rather nice cover page, kind of noble, manly sort of. It was just odd, but interesting. We see, Kisame has broken free of his shackles, and he, kind of reels off a few different techniques, seemingly at first to kind of, defend himself, perhaps get away, perhaps protect the information. We have a flashback to when Kisame, first meets Itachi. There is quite an interesting conversation, because that relationship between the two of them did always seem interesting. I don't really necessarily want huge focus on that relationship between the two of them, but it was a curious little one at that. So you get to see a little bit of conversation between the two of them, and Kisame makes some interesting points about what kind of person he is, and ends up killing himself with his own summoned sharks. So just that far through the chapter, Drew, your thoughts overall on everything that's taken place at that point?
That far, I thought it was an interesting take on, like, the sharks are cannibalistic creatures that, in the end, he has his own summons devour him. It certainly is, like, an in-character way for him to not reveal any additional information.
Yeah, very much so. Clint, how did you feel about this part of the chapter?
I thought it did a great job of keeping character status. I mean, keeping Kisame as this character who wanted to protect information above all else and do his job as a ninja. And what a fitting way for, like, a true ninja to go out as to, like, kill himself to protect what he knows. I mean, Naruto couldn't have done his character any more justice as a death.
Right. Ultimately, then, we see Killer B kind of moving towards Samehada, the sword of Kisame. Do we think that he's going to end up with the sword for good now, Drew?
Yeah, I think he's probably going to keep it. Unless, like, the suicide doesn't count, it doesn't automatically get transferred to the killer, but it feels like Killer B's got a sympathy for that sword and is going to take it.
Okay. And if that happens, Clint, are you okay with that?
You know, I don't know. I don't think it's going to find a permanent home with him. I think maybe a temporary one. But I think that the shark guy that's on Sasuke's team has wanted that sword for a while, so I think we might see him come into it at some point.
That's true. Yeah, very good point there. It's about time for them to show back up soon. Not that I want to see Sasuke, but it feels as though that kind of plot needs to start happening now.
The group he's gathered are tolerable characters. Granted, the girl won't be on his team anymore.
Well, no.
that's bumping up the averages. It's just a matter of whether they can handle Sasuke well, which they haven't been able to do.
No. And then Kisame ultimately is shown to have one last little trick. As Guy opens up the scroll, a new shark shows up, is summoned out of nowhere, and takes the scroll and starts to swim away with it rapidly. So it seems as though Kisame ultimately, even in death and shortly after death, has been able to exercise complete control over information. And I think one thing that I'm kind of taking away from this now is I've really enjoyed this focus on something so specific and detailed, like focusing exclusively on protecting information, that I'm a little disappointed it was never brought up sooner. Drew, do you get that feeling at all?
Yeah, I feel like he was a shallower character earlier because he was sort of companioned with Itachi, who was, if not a more interesting character, then more plot relevant.
Mm-hmm. And what about you, Clint? Do you feel that it would have benefited Kisame's character earlier in the series if we had more of a sense of what kind of person he was with relation to information?
Yeah, we'd only really gotten a story about him that he was just a bad guy, and he was one of the missing Nen who make up Akatsuki. We had never gotten any background information. I think Naruto as a whole would have been better off if we had seen more elements of, like, the ninja world like this, like information protection and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. To be fair, perhaps Kishimoto just hadn't thought of it yet. It's entirely possible. And the very interesting talking point at the very end of the chapter, on the last page, we see Uchiha Madara, who's facing off with Konan, but he calls her Nagato. There's a few different things to take away from that, but Clint, I'd just like to get your thoughts overall. You know, what did you take away from that scene?
I don't know what to think. I definitely don't want to see Konan die. She was a very good character, as far as the females in the series go. It's like plenty interesting and like has some character depth to her.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be kind of a kick right now after coming off that excellent Kisame fight to have Konan killed off.
Right. Yeah, I particularly love her powers. I mean, even aside from the fact that she is one of the more interesting females in the series, she also has one of the more interesting powers of any character, not just of any female. Drew, what did you make of the last page?
Yeah, I'm not sure what to think of it. I hope it's not like a clash fight to the death with either of them, because if it's a fight to the death, Konan is the one that's going to die.
Right. Now, what do you guys make of the fact that he calls her Nagato? Do you think she's one of the bodies now? Is that at all possible at this point?
I think Pain is, like, legitimately dead. I think it's just a question of, like, maybe she has some of his powers, maybe she has the same surname, maybe something.
Okay.
Maybe
she married him or something.
It could be. To be fair, I haven't checked the Raws. I don't know. I'd be very hopeful that they wouldn't make that kind of a mistake. that'd be a stretch. I guess we can't really theorize too much. I will say I agree with you, Clint. I really, really hope that she isn't just killed off. That's the one thing I can't stand with Madara and that style of villain, is just trying to reinforce his strength by just randomly killing off characters after other action has taken place in just kind of a heartbeat. And those are usually enjoyable characters that are killed off too, so I hope that doesn't happen. But overall then, was this a good chapter to you, Drew?
Yeah, I think it was.
Okay, and what about you, Clint?
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Okay, let us move now to Bleach, chapter 418, where we have a continuation of the face-off between Ichigo and Aizen. And boy, is Aizen talkative in this chapter. Was that just me, Clint, or did he just not stop talking?
He has more lines in this chapter than he has in every other chapter of Bleach combined.
It's ridiculous.
He's just got a lot on that agglutination.
Oh, I could go on for days about agglutination, man. That's crazy.
Of their arms with the Zanpakuto. I think that was kind of meant to be like, our arms have both joined with the Zanpakuto, but I didn't see that happening with Aizen's, so I have no idea what the shit he's talking about.
Yeah, that is the thing that confused me more. It wasn't so much the word choice, which is baffling, frankly. It doesn't really fit his character, and it doesn't make sense to try to look intelligent by just throwing in a random long word. That doesn't fit. However, the point that he's making, if you just take the point at face value, we haven't really seen anything to do with that. Yeah, I mean, we've seen Ichigo kind of take all the strength, condense his sword further and further to reinforce his body, but there was never really any emphasis on the arm playing a role in that. Certainly not at all with Aizen.
Until the chain wrapped around Ichigo's arm, we saw nothing of the sort.
And we have no explanation of the chain thus far, so I can't possibly take that as a credible explanation for why Aizen would come out and talk about agglutination. that is going in my everyday vocabulary, by the way. You can count on that.
I think he has some sort of endorsement deal with, like, Transdimensional Hot Topic.
I'm going to agglutinize that with my vocabulary. So, and then we get to, obviously, the the real focus of the chapter, which is Aizen is just going on and on about how much better he is than Ichigo, and Ichigo couldn't possibly have done anything, and look at my strength, etc., etc., etc. Shows off, and then slashes at Ichigo, and Ichigo stops it with one hand, and then pulls the old shonen cliche, no, it wasn't you who destroyed that mountain, it was me.
If he's just enhancing physical strength, like, he shouldn't be able to get around universe-warping gravity. There's certain, like, limits to the laws of physics that make that at all plausible.
No. You're right. I agree. This makes no sense whatsoever. Unless, and, you know, I'm not saying necessarily let's give Kubo credit. However, the only sense that we have that Ichigo has turned all of his Ryatsu into physical strength is Aizen saying that. So he could be the unreliable narrator at this point. He could falsely think that, and then Ichigo could turn around next week and have his twist be that, no, you were wrong, I actually have so much you can't sense it, or I'm warping reality, or something else. So we do have to take the concept that he is pure strength with a little bit of a grain of salt at this point. But if he is pure strength, then this is thoroughly ridiculous, Clint. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, if he does turn out to just have it pure reinforcement type strength, that would be beyond ridiculous. There's no way he should be beating Aizen's character with that, but I think we're seeing every indication that Aizen is wrong.
Right. I can't understand. I mean, even Bleach isn't that, well, not even just bad, just, like, confused, I would say. I don't even think Bleach could be that confused with its own power system. Do you?
Yeah, no. I certainly... I would hope not, but nothing Bleach could do would disappoint me, so...
Yeah.
It wouldn't be a surprise even if it were that way.
This is week two of the mullet, by the way. Has it grown on you at all? Do you guys like it more or less?
It's still not a real mullet to me.
Okay. Well, his hairstyle, then. Clint, your expert hair opinion.
He needs a truck driver hat.
Thank you. My name is Keith Stone. Oh, that's perfect. That is, someone please Photoshop that right now. Anyway.
But, by Keith Stone. That would make sense.
My name is Ichigo. All right, let's move on from that train wreck to Bakuman, Chapter 99, which is certainly by no means a train wreck. Quite a bit of impactful information in this chapter. First of all, the instant impact is that they did it. The phone call is that they beat Natural, and they were only two votes away from passing Crow. They didn't do it, so that's a little bit aggravating, but that's quite an achievement in and of itself. And the phone from Hattori's end is then passed to the editor-in-chief, who outright tells them, you know, congratulations, we're not going to cancel you, you're too successful. You're too big to fail, in today's terms. So that, in and of itself, we saw it coming for obvious reasons outside of the plot itself, because where else are they going to go if they're canceled from Jump? But this is still the legitimization of our thoughts. How do you feel about it now that it's happened, Clint?
I think it was an excellent conclusion to the arc, and just a good way to wrap things up, especially the editor-in-chief being like a congratulatory and telling them that they did a good job is a definite improvement over him just viewing everything they do with disdain and saying there's no possible way they can make it and things like that.
Yeah, that was a very nice moment of acceptance, really. Now, on the other hand, the moment could be interpreted as being a little bit cheapened by the fact that they didn't really just beat Natural on their own merit, because Natural placed sixth in that week. It was beaten by Seigi no Mikata and Road Racer Giri. So, yes, they've finally done it. Yes, this is a major achievement, but at the same time, they did it with help. Does that at all bother you?
Yeah, a little bit, but I mean, the almost more important to me is the fact that they were only, two or four votes behind Crow?
Two is what the translation that I read was two.
Yeah, I think that's almost more important at this point. That small of a number of votes behind Crow, that's more of an indication that they've made it.
Mm-hmm. Regarding Natural, the reason it placed so low is because evidently the plan to have Crow, the character, appear in Natural has totally backfired. While it got them votes up front, the novelty has worn off because they've continued to have Crow appear in the series. And that's why it dropped all the way to 6th. And so you see the scene between Miura and Iwase at the restaurant, and then Miura leaves, and Iwase begins crying over her own failure. And I found that to be a very difficult scene, very, very touching scene, because she's reflecting on her own personal failure, and it's completely her fault, which she seems to be accepting of the fact. But really, a rather difficult scene to read. How did you feel about that one?
It was difficult. I mean, she's been striving to get ahead of Takagi, and she just can't manage it now. He just pulled ahead at the last second when it mattered the most. And I think the overall lesson of this arc was that of short-term gains versus a long-term setup for a payoff. I think they kind of, the reason they're having her fail at this point is because she was so focused on just a short-term kind of like chapter gain in the rankings by using Crow.
Right. Yeah, so then the next major news, there's so much in this chapter, is that PCP is being adapted into a drama CD, which is just yet another very, very quick step. There's so much happening, not even just in the chapter in terms of content, but just plot-wise, it's moving forward very quickly. And of course, this then leads to, you know, who's going to play whom, voice actor and actress-wise. And so Mashiro, in a rather cute fashion, just goes kind of insane, freaks out, and, you know, is asking, oh, can we pick the voice actresses? And yeah, do you have someone in mind? Azuki Miho. So yeah. To me, that was a very cute and funny scene. Did you enjoy that?
Yeah, it was pretty good. I mean, it's exactly what you would expect him to do. Anything he hears about a voice role for one of their manga, of course, he's going to want to get her in as fast as he can.
Mm-hmm. Kaya reacts rather nicely to their relationship and the way that it is potentially progressing. And then Azuki's reaction upon finding out that she's been selected to play that role is also very nice, because she starts tearing up a little bit there. A lot of really, really strong emotional stuff in this chapter. But really, as nice and as notable as those things are, I think really the last page, when you see the two offers for an anime adaptation on the desk of the editor-in-chief, those are the most important because of his facial expression, in my opinion. It's not a very straightforward facial expression. Usually you would think, as someone involved in an editorial position, oh, one of my series is going to be adapted, this is good. He seems not to just have a very positive outlook. It seems, the initial impression that I got, and this could be a huge stretch, I admit, but it just seemed more like, I'm not sure if these guys are ready yet, maybe I shouldn't tell them. Did you get any kind of a bizarre feeling from this scene?
Yeah, I was wondering about that, and I mean, saying he does greenlight it, that presents a whole new set of problems, because what if whoever's making the animation decides that they don't want the voice actress who's currently working on the drama CD to be working on the animation? It would introduce a whole new set of problems for especially Mashiro and Azuki.
Right. Yeah, that's an interesting and kind of scary thought. But overall, as a chapter, this was just mile-a-minute stuff. I thought that this was a great chapter. What did you think of it?
Yeah, it was definitely a really good chapter with a ton of content in it. One thing I'm really wondering about is they've done this kind of meta thing with Bakuman throughout its entire creation. And what they've done with PCP and what Bakuman has done itself are kind of mirror images, like set up a long arc with a very intense climactic payoff. That's what they've done in both series, in the series in series and Bakuman itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm interested to see what's happened to the ratings, if Bakuman has done the same thing as PCP did and like taken a dip down towards the middle of this arc and then at this climactic end to it. Just, I wonder if it's going to come out really high in the rankings. That would be interesting.
That's a great point that you make. This is an excuse for me to plug the site, because I've gotten a table of contents now under the magazine info tab at the top menu. The table of contents reflect 8 weeks prior. So we're not going to find this out for a couple months exactly where these chapters are being ranked, but already Bakuman is placing rather consistently in the top 4 or 5. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. Certainly we're not going to be able to say, well, it took it from mid-tier to top-tier, because it's already kind of there, if not exactly there, really on the verge. But it'll be interesting to see if it starts getting consistently more votes than, say, Toriko, which is also up there rather consistently. I certainly don't expect it to be something like a Naruto, but if it does, then that's even more to your point, that people are taking note, and that would be the ultimate form of meta. Something in a series where they're doing something to the series they're creating in a series, and all of that is reflecting on real life towards the series. It'd be rather fun. It's now time to move to Beelzebub, Chapter 75, and the extra chapter we will briefly discuss. But Chapter 75, first of all, thoughts on the color. We have a color page and a color cover. I thought it was really, really nice. Drew, did you like that?
Yeah, I found that, like, it was an interesting cover page. Like, I'm not a huge fan of the sort of split panel type thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anyway, we begin, oddly, with Mickey's realization that Oga has remembered who he is, or perhaps has all along known who he is, and is finally accepting of him again, because Mickey has now opened his eyes. So Mickey is really, you know, back in the fold and really opening up to him, and asks him to call him by his first name. That
and Yaoi commences.
That is just, man... That is just bizarre. I mean, if you know anything about Japanese culture, you know that that is just really pushy in this sort of circumstance. Really bizarre. Clint, your thoughts?
I'm not sure what to think about that. That seems like something maybe Aoi would get a little jealous over him for asking.
Oh, that'd be hilarious. Of course, the reaction shot from both Oga and Baby BL was priceless. Specifically, Baby BL. So the girls are prevented from interfering in the upcoming fight by the Izuma and one of the members of the Ishiyama team. And so you have these different Tamo guys, all the bald guys, begin to attack Oga and Miki together. And this really starts to feel more like old Beelzebub, because the huge hulking member of Tamo charges at Oga with Death Trailer, is the name of his attack, and Oga stops it with one hand and says something to the effect of, like, is that all that you got? And takes him out with his new finishing attack. I think he called Super Rocket Punch this time. And Miki, conversely, also it gets a full page to show that he has his major attack wiping out some guy, too. So this is just, you know, unabashedly violent, but in a comical way and just straightforwardly, not brutal like gory, but just brutal like just very intense action. And that's what I've missed. Drew, your thoughts on just seeing pure action for once?
It was nice to see like 2 one-hit KO punches. It does feel more like classic Beelzebub. I haven't really been disappointed when it's going by recently, but this is the strongest point of the series.
Mm-hmm. And what about you, Clint? Is this a return to form for you, or were you satisfied with the volleyball?
I would say I was satisfied with the volleyball, but it's not everything that I expect from Beelzebub, and I definitely like this kind of action. At the same time, it does comedy so well that there's no reason it shouldn't mix both like it does.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of comedy, we get to see Furuichi given the chance, as he had been previously when everyone is always violent. He gets the chance to kind of give his little quip or two, and he has the chance again here. So it really does, at least to me, I won't speak for either of you, but it does feel to me as though it's a little bit of a return to form. It's a little bit of a throwback to what made the series what it is today. And then the chapter proper ends with Oga telling Baby BL full power. He uses the entire Zebub power at full power to take out Hisaya, which was the scene of the lines, the markings appearing across his face and his hair kind of being unruly. I really thought that was a great panel. I don't know, Clint, did you feel that way at all?
Yeah, kind of getting back to the old vicious style of Oga.
Mm-hmm. Which I've really missed. All the comedy, you're right, the comedy's been funny, but what really turned me onto the series to begin with is Oga, just Oga the character, the no-nonsense sort of jerk character that doesn't take anything into consideration. He's just himself, he's just violent, and that's who we have in this chapter again. So Drew, before we get to the extra chapter, your thoughts on this chapter as a whole?
I thought it was sort of interesting to see Oga using full power for once just to take out Kiria.
Mm-hmm. And what about you, Clint? Thoughts on the chapter?
It was good. Nice return to form.
Okay, cool. Now, the extra chapter, we don't need to take too much time on it, but it was a nice little change of pace. It was Baby BL versus cats.
And losing.
In a very amusingly epic sort of tone, but of course, it's about a little baby who's trying to fight cats and loses and gets made fun of by cats in cat language. I thought it was, you know, we don't need to spend much time on it, but I thought it was very cute, and I do appreciate having it as kind of the counterpart, the complement to Chapter 75, which was intensely violent, intensely action-packed, and you have this silly little story. So, did you like this one, Drew?
Yeah, I found it very enjoyable. Definitely a little bit more of Baby Beal doing his typical posing, posturing.
Yeah. And Clint?
Yeah, it was really funny, particularly after Bale lost and everyone was kind of making fun of him and he was down on himself. That was hilarious.
Yes. All right, well, from cats to cats, from tolerable cats, however, to not as such.
To wings. I think wings make the difference, really.
Yeah, you're right. Good point. Fairy Tale 198, in case you are lucky enough not to know what we're talking about. So, is it just me? How does no one notice all the cats flying back to the, like, quote-unquote real world with them through the vortex? They're all flying. Well, back at the very end of last chapter when they're all flying into the vortex and whatnot, they're all flying together through the vortex. How is everyone so surprised when the cats are there on the other side?
I have no idea. That did not make sense to me. Like, I would have think they would have known that, like, they're getting sucked in somewhere. Maybe they didn't think it'd be, like, a portal to the same location, but by the dialogue, they seem surprised that they're even in Earthland, and it's like, you shouldn't be, really.
Yeah, that to me, that just seems almost like an oversight. That makes no sense whatsoever to me. I'm just completely confused. And then we have a rather lengthy and tedious and frankly unnecessary story that this is kind of a habit of Mashima's, where he can't just leave anything well enough alone. He has to make everything the closest it can be to a flawlessly happy ending. And so we learned that, no, all the Exeed that were sent to the real world or what have you, Earthland, all those Exeed that were sent over, they weren't secret agents. They didn't have secret missions. In fact, they were being sent there to attempt to save them. And they, you know, they had their memories altered for their own benefit and things. Why couldn't it just have been a remnant of the past that was unfortunate, and then they're moving on from that? I mean, it still would be a very happy ending, because pretty much everyone's alive that is a quote-unquote good guy. But no, everything has to be as close to perfectly happy as possible. I really didn't like that. What about you?
I think it's a complex plot that actually takes moral complexity out of the series. And, like, I mean, moral complexity has never been a Mashima strong point, but it's been better even in other parts of Fairy Tale.
Yeah. We learned that Charlotte has the power of prediction, and that all of the Exeed were kind of pulling the same old, like, we're going to treat you badly for your sake. And then it turns out she's a princess. I mean, really? If you're trying to wrap up everything as positively as possible, you can't get more, you know, Fairy Tale, not Fairy Tale the series, but you can't get more, like, classic Fairy Tale than someone's a princess.
Why not?
Yeah. And then, this is, we're attempting to keep this a family show, so allow me to try to be diplomatic in my statement of this. Everyone picks up on a rather interesting hand gesture.
Circle jerk.
Yeah. What? Seriously. I'm at a loss for words, literally. I don't know what everyone is learning that motion. Why? Why was that even there to begin with, and then why is everyone learning it?
It feels like it's just a simple thing. Like, I find it kind of funny. Like, if Edelus had been better, that would have been, like, sort of a funny thing to wrap up the arc. As it is, it kind of just feels, like, tossed in there.
Yeah. We do have one serious point of note at the very end. Lysana shows up. Panther Lily has kind of caught her or brought her to the group. Lysana, who every time she's been previously mentioned, Natsu has become extremely serious, which is not exactly befitting of him. The last time that there was something this serious, you know, at the end of an arc and into a new one, it was the disappearance of Fairy Tale, and I got really excited for that, and then Edelus happened. So I refuse to be suckered in again. I'm not going to get my hopes up, but
I mean, I'm more optimistic for this when I was when Fairy Tale disappeared. Kind of, because, like, this is something we've actually been built up to.
Yeah.
Something he probably has a little more advanced planning about than just, like, oh, I'm going to go to a parallel universe and waste about half a year's worth of chapters.
Do you think this at all could be getting back into the plot of Natsu looking for his dragon father?
I hope so, and I think it could.
Okay, great. Let's move on now. Hayate no Gotoku chapter 286. Continuing from last chapter, when Hayate ran into that bizarre pretty girl who no one knows, she kind of immediately becomes rather clingy, rather fawning all over him. But then Hayate does manage to, you know, get away. He moves over to find Tama and finds Izumi. And Izumi gives him a collar to put on Tama so that logically he would look more like a cat rather than a tiger, because that makes perfect logic in her mind, of course, because she's brilliant.
It's a magical bell collar, though.
Yes, Pardon me. How dare I underestimate the most intelligent character in that series? I love her, actually. I shouldn't make fun of her. She's really, really funny. Then the scene shifts back to the apartment complex, where we see some different characters, but then the new tenant shows up, and it's that same girl, the same pretty unknown girl, who's aiming to be a new tenant. And she's, again, completely clingy, and she ends up hugging Hayate right when Nagi walks in. So certainly there's going to be some kind of drama there, because Nagi is always very possessive of Hayate, even if they don't actually ever really advance their relationship. So lots of different points of humor there, specifically Maria's reactions at a couple different points. But what did you take away from the chapter?
It was just really good Hayate comedy, and hopefully setting us up for some more comedy with the conflict between this new girl and Nagi, and hopefully we find out who this new girl is, why she's so obsessed with butlers, and in particular, obsessed with Hayate. Mm-hmm. Maria's comedy was just, her comedy is always so good. Her saying, oh, yeah. "My, what a cute girl, Hayate," while like pinching his ear and like giving him that suspicious look.
She's always a little bit devious in her treatment of Hayate, but it's done in a fantastic way, really. Again, we can't really talk at great length about Hayate simply because it's very straightforward, funny, but there's not too much depth to it. Do you think potentially we're going to get into? Well, first, let me ask this: do you think that this character, that the random new girl, is someone we should know about? Is someone of note in some capacity, or is she just a new girl?
I don't. She's got to have some connection to someone. I can't imagine there just being a completely unrelated person being introduced at this point in the manga. I mean, it could be, but yeah. I think it's more likely that she has some connection to the story in some fathom.
There was a little bit of emphasis played, very little, placed on the old mansion again and on all of Nagi's fortunes. Do you think that possibly there's a way that this girl could be connected to kind of getting her back into the super rich life?
That could be possible. I mean, after the comments they made in this chapter, I definitely think they're going to try to do that. I mean, after Tama was saying, "I can't stay in this place forever," and Hayate was saying, "We have to find a way to get the mansion back," that's mm-hmm. definitely going to come up in a future arc. They're going to have to get Nagi back to being, like, ridiculously rich, flying around everywhere in a helicopter and stuff.
Right. All right. History's Strongest Disciple, Kenichi, Chapter 396, which is the conclusion of the flashback that regards Apachai Hapachai and Agarjung Sai. It's essentially Apachai kind of just going around being good old happy-go-lucky Apachai, you know, a little bit comical, certainly not entirely aware of his own strength or the way that people would treat his strength. But then Agard finally, we get to sort of see why the conflict arises between the two of them, because he returns after having disappeared last chapter. He returns to the school and has killed a few, and so he faces off with Apachai, and then Agard again goes his own way and begins to invade the underground Muay Thai headquarters to fight the most renowned fighters there, and it's revealed that Agard has found Yami. And he's kind of challenging Apachai, you know, why are you holding yourself back deliberately so as not to hurt people, so as not to fulfill your own development? You know, come with me to Yami because, you know, you need to reach your apex. You need to reach your peak as a martial artist. So do what you're supposed to do. And then we progress finally back to the present-day fight where Apachai makes a statement like, you know, I found Kenichi. That's why I'm as strong as I am right now. So, Drew, thoughts on the entire chapter as a whole, specifically to begin with, though, the wrapping up and the overall flashback?
I think the flashback, I'm sort of back and forth on it, because this chapter of flashback wasn't that great, but, like, previous chapters have been entertaining, and additionally, I've sort of gleaned a little bit more about Apachai's growth from this. Like, it feels more impactful that we've seen him as, like, someone who was, like, on the verge of being, like, Killer Fist Satsujinken type. Mm-hmm. And, like, before he found Kenichi, he really didn't know how to hold back. We're sort of just showing his own desire to, like, be a less deadly martial artist here. And I thought that was interesting.
Okay. Clint, your thoughts on the flashback as a whole and the way that it was ended?
I kind of think that the flashback needed to happen here. I mean, we needed the background on Agard and Apachai, and I don't think it would have been as impactful elsewhere in the series before they had really, like, begun a conflict between each other. I didn't like this chapter of flashback as much as the others, but I still thought it was good and definitely showing us that Apachai like refused to go down the path of the Satsujinken, the Killing Fist, and instead chose a different life. And knowing in the earlier arcs of Kenichi how, like, they trained Appachai to go easy on people, like, treat them like you would a kitten or a small child.
Or a tiger cat.
It adds background to it.
The one thing, and again, I've made it very clear both on the website and on Beamcast that I've not been a fan of the flashbacks, specifically because of their placement right now. But taking that completely out of the equation, I was rather let down by the explanation for the ultimate conflict between Appachai and Agard, because to take the time where Matsue and Asune has done now, to take the time now to establish a flashback, kind of it seemed to me like it was going to set up a really big moment, a really big point of conflict, some really big event in their collective past that set them against each other. And instead it was more just, well, we went our separate ways. That, to me, was a disappointment. I take it you don't share that thought, Drew?
I mean, to me, it was an impactful moment last chapter when he killed the guy, like, after letting him win in the ring, he killed the guy, like, such that he would die immediately after becoming champion. I think that was an impactful moment, and it sort of, like, established his character such that him going to Yami would be natural. It still feels a little weak to just, like, have him left. He's left this chapter, and then he's in Yami. It feels a bit abrupt. It feels like it would be nice to see a little more of him in this chapter. If that had happened, I would have been perfectly okay with it.
Okay. And what about you, Clint?
We weren't really set up for any kind of revenge plot. Appachai never really said that he wanted revenge on Agard for something. And that's not how the Masters and Ryo's Unpak work anyway. They don't operate under forms of, like, revenge. So I don't know. Maybe an event, like, big, like killing someone that they both cared about would have been kind of out of place, given that.
Okay. Yeah, I suppose that does make sense. So now we're finally back at the present fight. Is there any reason why we can't just get the fight underway now? Is there any other outstanding plot point that we have to hit before the fight? I don't think so.
I don't really think so. I think, like, as they're fighting, he's going to mention why Kenichi is important, and I think that's fairly obvious for anybody who's been reading the series since the beginning.
Okay.
Unless we're going to give Tirwit a flashback now.
No, please no. Just get on with the damn fight. Let's get on with the damn show. A little bit of a change of order. Let's talk about Arago, chapter 33, and werewolves. Out of nowhere, but
yep.
Werewolves. First of all, no, they can't possibly exist. Are you kidding me? There's only doppelgangers and ghosts and the Brionok power and all this other crazy stuff. Electrical manipulation. But no, there's no werewolves. Oh, there's werewolves.
That's essentially it.
It was, first of all, definitely a sudden change of pace. Obviously, last arc was a sizable arc considering the relative length of the series. So getting into any new arc is going to feel a bit different at first. But it felt a little sudden. Not bad by any means, but just a little sudden. The way that it was comedic at first with Arago himself saying, like, oh, clearly it's an animal that escaped from the zoo. When examining the bodies and the crime scene at the beginning of the chapter, to going from comedy like that to just blatantly introducing some other kind of supernatural element, enjoyable, and I'm very curious to see what happened, but I just felt it was kind of unexpected to me. How did you feel about this chapter?
I feel like it was an interesting chapter. I liked the way that Special Crimes was called in right away because it was an unusual case, and then. Of course they're going to bring up it's a zoo animal, because that's what they always do in, like, Wolfman comedies before they know for sure. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it definitely looks like an interesting arc, definitely probably not related to the main plot. That's more what I'm worried about. Like, can Arago handle, like, arc-based plots the way it has in the past successfully?
Yeah. Could it at all be related to the main plot? Could this, in some capacity, be an extension of the power that Patchman has kind of made relevant in this world, brought into the world, perhaps? Could this just be like an offshoot of that, maybe? Could it be a direct underling or something?
I didn't think about it being like a Patchman creation, but you're right, it could be. And that would, I think, definitely make this arc more relevant.
Not
that it's not interesting enough as it is.
Yeah, I share your sentiment that this is interesting, but I do feel that the conflict with Patchman, including his underlings, you know, certainly Lucian was very interesting, but that was very much related to Patchman, and that's kind of, at this point, what ties the series together. I would worry at this point in time about completely branching away from that, so I hope that this has some relation to Patchman. Yeah, but definitely an introductory chapter, so we can't spend too much time on that. Let us move now to Toriko, chapter 108. this is going to be an interesting discussion. So, I don't even know how to begin. This is a very slash happy chapter, let's say.
Yeah, it's pairings I'm uncomfortable with, the chapter.
Let's preface
it's
this.
One pairing.
Let's preface this in a completely politically correct sort of way, which is actually how I happen to feel. You know, if you're into boys love, if you're into yaoi, you know, more power to you. Enjoy yourself, and certainly do not judge you for that. I just find it kind of striking and unusual when there are very, very strong hints placed in the pages of everyday shonen. Not to say necessarily that they shouldn't. I'm not judging. I just don't expect it. And when you have two characters simultaneously eating a vegetable that looks like a giant tongue, and then embracing each other afterwards, and then one of them remarks that if you turn it upside down, it looks like a heart. Perhaps uncomfortable is not the right word. I'm perfectly comfortable with people's enjoyment of that, but definitely unexpected is the right word. Is this intentional at this point, Drew?
I don't know, there is the whole issue that's been brought up. You could say that Shonen Jump has been accused of making its characters more slashable in recent years. This would certainly play into that, and you definitely feel like the biggest gap Toriko would have would be in female readership. Certainly, it could be a way to pick up viewership. That said, I wasn't really bothered by this chapter. I found, it was something to chuckle at, the little bits of yaoi hints that here and there. But at the same time, you still get the whole sensation of him eating the herb, the ozone herb, aside from Komatsu and Toriko forming the combination.
Right. I mean, I wasn't bothered in a moral sense. I was bothered in a sense wow, this just doesn't, it just seems like it came out of nowhere, that is all to me. I mean, yeah, there have been a few hints before, but this was just so many of them packed so very tightly into one chapter. Clint, thoughts on the chapter? There is plot to discuss in the chapter, the fact that that Toriko improves his gourmet cells, that they are now a combo, but thoughts on the overall chapter, whether or not that relates to yaoi?
Well, obviously, I only want to talk about the parts that relate to yaoi,
but I
will talk about the other parts, regardless. The creature at the end was kind of confusing. I mean, it looks exactly like a GT Robo, but Toriko says, a GT Robo... No.
Yeah.
It will be something else. I'm not sure.
Yeah, my thought on the site when I reviewed it is that perhaps the GT Robos are based off of an existing animal out in the wilderness. Could it be something like that? Could it be a completely different make of robot? Maybe not a GT Robo, but an SQ Robo, some other controllable beast?
Feeling like it's a robot based on the way the dialogue and that was set up.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it could be a plant monster or something, something that stands at the top of vegetable sky. Possibly another ingredient that Toriko incidentally picks up.
That would be interesting. And then, obviously, the other big point of note that I briefly mentioned is the fact that Toriko did ask Komatsu to form the combo, and Komatsu was quite obviously more than happy to oblige. So they are now officially a combo. We've kind of taken that for granted all this time, because it kind of has... The story needed to go in that direction, but again, this is, you know, as with Bakuman, this is the affirmation of something that we needed to have happen. So for you, Drew, how was that moment of affirmation?
It was all right. It was obviously came on a little bit strong, but I think it needs to happen because being a combination is a big deal, and Komatsu as a character is kind of what pushes up the series as high as it is, so this is sort of affirmation that he'll be around in the future.
Good. And Clint, you?
Yeah, I liked it. It needed to happen. And I also liked how the man that Toriko takes his orders from kind of set all this up to happen. Probably knew that the ozone herb needed to be picked the way it was with two people at a time. Probably knew that you could only eat it if you ate it with someone else. I kind of feel like this whole ordeal that Toriko's been through was set up by him in the interests of Toriko gaining a combo.
So he's like Chuck Woolery. He's setting them up on a date.
Yeah.
Great. Yeah, I like Ichiru even more now. All right. Gamaran, Chapter 61. Man, we get to talk about this 2 weeks in a row. I'm surprised. Gamaran 61 sees two separate two-on-one fights. Continuing from last chapter, we get to see Iori taking on the two remaining fighters of the trio that had been sent to dispatch him. Obviously, he one-shotted the first one, but he did sort of defeat the second one, but he left him alive. And then the third one, he didn't even manage to take out whatsoever. And now those two are fighting him at once. And have all sorts of trickery. They've managed to catch him in a couple different chains. I think they've chained, if I recall correctly, they've chained his arm, one of them has, and the other one has chained his neck and other arm because Iori was fast enough to move his arm up to stop him from being choked at the neck only. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's how he's been restrained. I'm not sure how long that'll last, given what we've seen of his character recently. Chains don't seem like the kind of thing that would stop him.
No, if anything, I get the feeling he could, if he wanted to, swing one into the other. Seems freakishly strong. And then on the other side of events, here we have Ito Ranmaru, facing off against two different ones, but he's facing off against the stronger ones, I would guess. I mean, we haven't really seen comparative strength really discussed among the trio that went out and then the two that are against Ranmaru, but certainly it seems that they're the ones that are either kind of loners or giving out the orders, so they seem more important. And Ranmaru, you know, fights off a couple different attacks from each of them. He fights off, like, the tube spear, which was a spear with a tube at the end, so just the blade part of it kind of retracts and extends, is the way that I understood that. And then the other user went after him just with unbridled strength, pure strength, which he's saying, you know, this will break anything that it comes into contact with, and Ranmaru is able to redirect it to hit the ground. And then at the end of the chapter, he's quite confident, saying, you know, okay, finally, here comes the chance for me to show the full extent of my abilities. We saw a little bit of Ranmaru earlier, and granted, he looked rather strong in his one major fight to date, but I'm still very surprised to see that he's going to perhaps have the chance to take out two characters who seem quite strong at the same time. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, we originally kind of, like, were introduced to him on a Zenmaru level of power, along with the guy that uses the huge sword. They were introduced together, and you kind of were taken to believe that they were similar in strength. But if he's able to take these two people on at once, that seems to not be the case.
Right. Surely Zenmaru, in terms of just pure strength, might be able to, but he doesn't have the techniques, the capability to back that up. He would not be able to take on two at once. So if Ranmaru can, how strong are these guys? This is ridiculous, Frank. We should get some more of these guys on the tier list. This is insane. Are you happy, pleased overall? I mean, it's kind of a weird parallel chapter with two different two-on-one fights, but I still found it to be rather interesting. What do you think?
Yeah, it was pretty interesting. I'm hoping that we'll get to see the fights and that it doesn't cut away back to Gama and Zenmaru running away.
Mm-hmm.
Too much cutting between all the things that are happening right now could detract from the actual action of what's going on.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. All right, The World God Only Knows, Chapter 112. Could you briefly summarize what happens and your thoughts on it, Drew?
Well, Kama sort of picks up from his rejection last chapter. He goes and tries to go into a bit more detail with Akari about why she rejected him. Like, they deal a bit more with emotions and, like, in the process, he asks Elsie to hug him, and she does it from behind, causing a similar blush effect. Meanwhile, Kama, like, uses all varieties of techniques to try and get Akari to, like, get him back into the picture, from, like, a megaphone to puppets to, like, chasing her up onto the roof. In the meanwhile, we see that the robot's been modified, the robot she's building, to, like, have dialogue lines, and she seems to be increasingly resembling a Galgei heroine, the robot, not the creator. Which makes me kind of curious still as to how this arc is going to be resolved.
To me, and this is maybe unfair, but maybe not, to me this chapter very much just felt like last chapter again. There were a couple different nuances that were introduced in this chapter, but it was very much the same dynamic between Kaima and the girl as last chapter, and didn't expand upon that too much. Yeah, we had the scene with Elsie, and yeah, we have the revised robot, and we had the puppet show, but aside from that, it was, I don't feel as though it really broke new ground from anything that was going on last week and last chapter. Clint, how'd you feel about this one?
Yeah, it was kind of a lot of the same things going on. I kind of felt the same way you did, that there wasn't too much important going on. At the same time, I think it kind of set up in my mind what will be the resolution of this, and purely speculation on my part, but I think he's going to have to capture the robot.
Huh. Yeah, that'd be... that. Wow. Clever. Yeah, I would actually like that a lot, come to think of it. I hope that happens. Drew, thoughts on the chapter?
That theory would be pretty awesome. I kind of enjoyed the chapter just for like the comedy moments. There wasn't a whole lot of plot advancement, I admit.
Mm-hmm. Well, in that case, yeah, that's a great theory, Clint. I really hope you're right. And we will remember. You will get a prize of some kind. Siren, chapters 132 and 133 have come out this week. Thank you very much, Scanlators, for speeding up that one. Chapter 132 is the reason earlier why we tiered Amamiya Sakurako, because she just busts out with this crazy Nova power. You see her be able to split into two. She has her regular, quote-unquote, regular personality and her Yandere personality or what have you, the more perverted personality towards Yoshina, at least. And she essentially just takes out that teleporter rather quickly. You get revealed the full extent of her powers, the mind reading, the full extent of all the psychic abilities that she has. And then the following chapter shifts focus away from her and more towards Oboro and a few other characters. Could you briefly summarize what happens on 133 then, Drew?
In 133, we see Shao and Kabuto sort of like following one of the generals in a little bit of a plot element, and they have no clue what's happening there, and frankly, neither do I. Meanwhile, we see Oboro like fighting Granna and losing, and meanwhile, the mention, which I thought was a real nice touch, that Oboro, because of all the wise fears he took in, like, can no longer go back to the real world. He's effectively stuck in Siren, and if like the dust is cleared from the atmosphere, he won't even be able to go outside then, so...
Yeah,
it's odd seeing it adds a bit of depth to his character, I think, showing that much about him.
And I think much needed depth too, because I don't think that he was too high on either of our lists. He was kind of always in the background, and when he showed up, he wasn't necessarily the most engaging or interesting to me. This really helps to flesh out his character to me, at least.
Yeah, it does. And before that, I was kind of thinking of him as an unresolved plot thread.
Mm-hmm. Does that conclude the chapter then? Was there more to that
another
chapter?
Half to it. Yeah, there's Amamiya is sort of counting down the number of enemies that they'll have to still face because it looks like there's some sort of stamina limit on their power just from implications that have been made. And then Matsuri and Kagetora apparently got calling cards to Siren and are now in the game.
So great.
They arrive in the future and apparently Matsuri's going to fight for like the first time against Granna, who's like the penultimate boss, which is an interesting touch to finally see the mentor character fighting at this point in the game.
Yeah, because I don't believe we've seen her fight at all, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's great. I'm very, very interested by what will happen from that. I thought really a good stretch of two chapters. You had finally a real moment of spotlight for Amamiya, who she has some moments before, but never really... She never really felt like she was deserving of that moment.
Yeah,
it felt more
fighting. She was one of the people who got in the split off fights.
Right. It felt more like it's now her turn to fight rather than for the sake of positive progression with the plot. We now must have her undergo her plot point, her fight. This one did feel more like that. She's actually evolved with the Nova. You know, who knows how we'll feel about her once we get to see Ageha's Nova, but it was at least a nice moment from that regard. And then, yeah, seeing Matsuri and Kagetora showing up in Siren, I loved that because I love those two characters. The relationship between the two especially, I thought, was always fantastic. In fact, that was even touched on a little bit in the chapter, so nice to see that that hasn't been dropped. So very much looking forward to that. Zettai Karin Children, Chapter 229, another in our psychic block of series here. What happened in this one, Drew?
Well, we see them starting to practice for the play, and Patty is adapting the play, because evidentially the original like plot of the play, the original ending, was a bit different from the one Minamoto remembered, and this is actually a very sophisticated and I thought very smoothly executed attempt to cover for the fact that Sheena did not know what he was talking about last chapter. He actually went back and did the research between that one and this one and figured out that, yeah, I was kind of wrong about like how this play ended. So that actually leads to a really interesting moment with Patty rewriting the play to give it a more interesting ending, like a less tragic ending, because like there is a limit to what you want to do in even a high school play, like for a class festival. You don't want to make it that heavy, and like that's interesting because it sort of ties in with the theme of like trying to change the future, because like this way they can give him a happy ending, which Kaoru says, and it feels a little cliched when she says it, but that really is how this play is sort of working out. Right. I really like the dynamic setup here.
Now, Feather plays a semi-prominent role in this chapter. She keeps, obviously, toying with Minamoto, trying to, you know, get under his skin. But also, aside from just, you know, nagging at him a little bit, she does seem to have a point. She does seem to be hinting at something. And there's obviously more being made of, you know, whose future is she remembering? Is it as straightforward as she's remembering Kaoru's future, or is there another twist up ahead? Do you have any thoughts on how this is going to happen?
I feel like Feather is going to be a surprise. It's not going to be any of the obvious like main characters.
Okay.
It feels like it's going to be a prominent side character who's going to figure into this somehow.
Okay. Anything else that you take away from this chapter, then?
Not particularly.
Well, we shall move on now to something completely different. Hajime no Ippo, chapter 906, sees Itagaki retreat to his corner and receive the best advice of all time, really. Nothing.
Pay attention.
He gets pay attention. That's all he gets out of his second. Let's take a moment, without going too in detail to the analytical side of seconds in boxing, but... Clint, you originally had made a good point about the development of this second. Drew, what was his name again?
Shinoda.
Shinoda, thank you. Clint, you had originally made a point about Shinoda in pre-show. Could you refresh our memory on that, please?
Yeah, he had the whole arc to himself where he said, if either Aoki or Kimura don't win, then I'm going to quit my job as a second because maybe it's my fault that they're doing badly. And he had that whole arc to like reaffirm his character that he's not the reason that they're failing and that he's a good corner and he gives good advice. And then this time he just seems really useless. And like it's a weird thing to do to his character for me.
Yeah, I was struck by the exact choice of advice that he gave, or I suppose didn't give, because I understand the thought process behind it, at least. The thought process being that, you know, Itagaki has messed up. That's pretty obvious at this point. He came in either too cocky or with a wrong game plan, or, you know, not taking the opponent seriously, or a combination of all those things and more. It's obvious that Itagaki has messed up, and it's obvious that he needs to learn a lesson. But in my opinion, at least, certainly I'm no boxing expert, but in my opinion, at least, you would send him out there with some piece of constructive advice, something for him to work on, or even some kind of a more obvious hint of what to focus on from Kurosawa, what to focus on in your own mistakes, anything. Instead, he just sends him out there to the wolves to learn, and learning is all well and good, but, you know, Itagaki can do that all by himself. What does he need the second there to tell him that for? So I was struck by that choice of just saying paying attention. How did you feel about that, Drew?
I felt like, in some ways, the whole, like, after they got out of the corner, after he was like, yeah, this is going to be an important experience for him, I'm like, yeah, but at the same time, he needs to give, like, at least Itagaki some sort of advice, and eventually, like, because he doesn't do that, we're forced to reference back to the Wooly fight where Ippo set a goal of just, like, I'm going to hit him once. And that seems to be what Itagaki's heading for.
Yeah, that is one of the two major points remaining after the second sends him out with the worst advice ever. The first one being that Itagaki realizes, okay, yes, I did mess up, and that Ippo is just that great. Are you okay with that? Are you okay with him accepting it? Just at all, whether no matter which way he will interpret that and react to it. Are you okay with him realizing that Ippo is great, Drew?
That's what I wanted to happen from the beginning of this fight. I think he was aiming too high. He was cocky.
Good. And Clint?
Yeah, it's definitely because of the whole conflict between, like, I'm in the same weight class as Ippo. What if I have to play against him and we're in the same gym so I can't him getting sat down and told, like, you're not at that level even close yet is probably what he needed.
Right. And then the last bit that Drew touched on is the realization that he can now set some kind of a similar goal. You know, he needs to throw out the concept of aiming for a goal like beating Ippo's record and instead focus on something like making contact with Karasawa so many times. Are you okay with him taking that kind of a similar approach, Drew?
I'm not totally okay with it. I feel like this could play out better in the fight than it did in the Wooly fight because Karasawa is a less broken opponent.
Mm-hmm. You're no kidding. You're saying that something in any other arc of Ippo could be better than Wooly.
I'm sure Takamura would pound his face in.
Oh, what I wouldn't give just to see that. Even like a street fight, just anything. And Clint, what about you? Are you okay with Itagaki going after the same type of goal as Ippo was in the Wooly fight?
You know, it's all right. But I would have been much better than that would have been a piece of advice from the corner, from Shimoda. He told him to pay attention, so he obviously realizes that there's something going on that Itagaki doesn't know about. Maybe a piece of advice that's closer and slightly less cryptic than that would have been better.
Right. Yeah, I think we all tend to agree on that one. All right, moving on. Good ending, chapter 49, which is almost the entirety of the trip to Yuki's house. First, Seiji and his two friends, Eri, and I think it was Izumi, if I don't recall the name, actually. He's not important. Seiji and his friends go out and basically can't find the house immediately because the map is terrible. Wah, wah. So they're just asking around. They come across some friends of Yuki's from middle school. And these friends are, in my opinion, very bizarrely open about someone else's personal life. Did you get that feeling at all that, like, wow, you are really opening up about someone else, Drew?
Maybe a little bit. I just get the feeling that sometimes people are chatty and, like, they're just being talkative because they're assuming the best. Like, I wouldn't open up as much necessarily about troubles. And, like, I give him some credit for, like, saying, like, we're not going into too much detail about Yuki and Toru. You'll have to ask that herself. Mm-hmm. I give them a little credit for that. It's a little more talkative than I would have been if somebody asked me about my friends. But if they were presumably already friends, I would be willing to share a little bit of information at least.
Okay. Eventually, Seiji and friends make it to Yuki's house. Yuki is not home, but Yuki's mom catches them at the door and invites them in and begins asking a rapid-fire string of questions, which kind of leads you to believe that Yuki's mom doesn't really hear from Yuki very much because she's asking things like, how's she doing in school? Is she doing anything sporting-wise? How are her studies going? Is she bringing lunch? Et cetera, et cetera. Like, things that she should have some awareness of, maybe not the intricate details, but it seems like they're somewhat disconnected. Eventually, Seiji bolts off because he's worried about Yuki, and he finds her at the old meeting spot where she and Toru used to be, or where she would go to collect her thoughts, or what have you. And there's a nice little heartwarming reunion sort of scene, and then that's pretty much the end of this little mini arc. They seem to be, everything's fine, and they're just going to go back to town. And then there's Toru, not with them, but Toru runs into one of the friends that had been revealing all of Yuki's past to Seiji and friends. And says, "Oh yeah, you just missed her. You just missed her being Yuki, because she knows that Yuki's back in town. Maybe you'll see her sometime soon." And then reveals the fact that Toru lives in the same city where I don't know what city this series takes place, but wherever it is that Seiji and Yuki and Sho all go to school, Toru is in that city also. To me, that was kind of a 1-2 punch because I was so set up for a really positive moment with this just being a little one chapter mini arc with not too much drama, and they're just going to go back home. And then all of a sudden there's Toru, who's obviously going to feature prominently in the plot from now on. And I'm very not okay with that. What are your thoughts on that?
I think like it's going to lead to more romantic drama of the like other love interest kind. And I think that's been what's dragging this manga down. I don't think it being a guy will make it better. Mm-hmm. A solid thumbs down for that particular twist.
Yeah, very disappointed by that, which is really too bad because this could have been a pretty good chapter. It was going to be resolved rather easily, but not at all looking forward to the several chapters to come at this point, thanks to Toru. Romance block next up is Kimi no Irumachi 103, which Drew has caught up on, so I don't have to talk about it all alone anymore and have my heart broken all alone every week as I read new chapters. So briefly, before we get into the individual chapter discussion of 103, you've just caught up on the entire thing. What are your thoughts overall?
I feel like it's very nice. It has the right blend of slice of life to be romance, to be still, like, emotionally deeply romantic, and at the same time, not over sappy, over melodramatic with it, like Good Ending has been recently. And because of the amount of time it takes, because of the way it does time skips and gradual passage of time, you can introduce multiple romantic interests without it really feeling as hackneyed.
Okay. And something that I find interesting, you seem to have a rather positive overlook of the entire series, and you've just marathoned the entire series, whereas you've probably been hearing me, you, Drew, and you, the audience, have heard me and saw me right on the site, that it was good for a considerable length of time, and then it just got so angsty, so dramatic, that it was really a struggle to read a week after week. Was, in your opinion, is this more of a marathon type of read because you can just follow arcs sequentially and they just lead into other plots?
I feel like it leads into itself very naturally. I feel like the jumping off to Tokyo was a little bit slow at first, but I think the overall arc was paced well enough that when you read it all at once, like, it's not emotionally dragging on you. I did really like the banter between Kazuma and Haruto after, like, their publicly acknowledged romantic rivals. I thought that was just a great little bro scene.
Yeah, I do have to agree with you on that one. So let's now focus on the chapter at hand. Again, this is chapter 103, and we see Kiyomi, who's back. First of all, were you at all taken aback by the fact that she seems rather okay after being so destroyed over the death of the man she loved for so long?
Well, it has been about 2 months, and I feel like as teenagers, you've got to be able to recover eventually from something like that.
Okay.
I feel like it fits in again with the way this series does passage of time. Like, it lets things happen.
Right. Okay. So Kiyomi is back, and she seems to potentially, this is rather early on to speculate, but she seems potentially like she could be part of a new love triangle between herself and Haruto and Mishima. Obviously, Mishima last chapter confessed to Haruto at his apartment. But there's been another slight passage of time since then, so things are quote-unquote weird, according to the side text. Kiyomi, when Mishima has to step aside and take a phone call as all three of them are talking, Kiyomi basically outright says, you know, come, why don't you just invite her back to your place over winter break? She wants to see the snow. She wants to be around you. Stop beating around the bush. Just invite her already. And Haruto responds in such an interesting way, a very mature way, I felt, that he's talking about his feelings for Eba and the fact that he just doesn't feel he loves her anymore, the fact that he can accept that the way that things have turned out, when he heard the words from Eba, like, maybe we shouldn't see each other anymore, that he realized that things just were not going to improve. He outright says, I just don't love Eba as much as I used to. For as mired in the drama surrounding Eba as the series had been for a long time, I am tremendously impressed by this progress, this step forward in this chapter. How did you feel about it?
I feel like I really enjoyed him. It's a moment of character evolution you rarely see outside of someone who's already in a relationship, being able to get over that. Mm-hmm. I think it was really interesting and actually really realistic the way they portrayed it, just affection breaking down over time rather than just like pining and growing more intense. It right. feels like it has a very authentic feel to it romantically.
Okay, and then ultimately Haruto does invite Mishima back to his hometown, but Kiyomi is coming too. Now, we didn't exactly get to see that. It was off screen, but I thought that was a nice little to me, as I mentioned earlier with Beelzebub, kind of a throwback to what made the series what it was when it was at its peak of enjoyability, same sort of thing here. I really feel that this mix of genuine emotion and romantic plot, but mixed with lighthearted comedy moments, you know, the feigning the insult, the turning away from Mishima as she's so offended by the fact that Kiyomi's coming along also, I thought that works rather nicely. Did you enjoy the chapter as a whole? Pardon me, Drew?
Yeah, I enjoyed it pretty much.
Great. That concludes the weekly group discussions, and it's time for me to cover what I read, beginning with Bloody Monday Season 2, Chapter 39, where we are shown that Hansel and Peter Pan are both alive. They kind of swapped out. The corpses that we saw last chapter were the workers. They were not the terrorists, as had been predicted, or as had been expected, I suppose. And the supposed workers who had been saved had swapped clothes with them, So they are Hansel and Peter Pan, the you know, bizarre fairy tale related code names. And so they're beginning to escape, and Hibiki goes after them, obviously to the dismay of Fujimaru, who is, you know, obviously more worried about her now than ever, now that they're in love. Hibiki goes after them. She's been healed. She has a gun. But evidently she's heading right into a trap because Peter Pan, with his ridiculous hacking techniques, has some sort of satellite cell phone hookup thing. So her GPS or something or other, she is heading straight into a trap. It was more of a setup chapter than other Bloody Monday chapters have been recently. I mean, there was still action in it. There were still revelations in it, obviously, most specifically the fact that the workers had been swapped. But still more of a setup chapter, still rather enjoyable. Going to introduce a new series to my discussion this week, Codebreaker, which I've covered on the site off and on for quite some time. Finally seem to have consistent scanlations from, I believe it's a Shinra Tensei. Thank you so much to you guys for catching up on that. In the long span of time that we missed since I last talked about it on the site, I'm not going to go through everything. I just want to say that the fight between Ogami and the one being sought turned out to be quite good. What's happened since then has been really, really up or down with the introduction of the code names over the code breakers. Some of them are really good. Some of them are kind of questionable. And then the position of the old code breakers against Ogami, who's kind of now a fugitive from his own group. Interesting, but again, up and down. In terms of this exact chapter, chapter 101, we get to see the flashback between Ogami and Yuki, where Ogami kind of saves the cats, and Yuki happens to be one of them because of his rare form, his weakened form after he uses up all of his powers, so he kind of saved him unintentionally. We flash forward to the present again, so we've understood now why Yuki has certain different feelings, more than just being another codebreaker alongside Ogami. Ogami tries to get back up again after his arm has been severed off of him, but he collapses because it turns out that his arm is kind of his life essence. It's kind of his heart, is the way that they put it. So he collapses, and Sakura Koji saves his arm. You end up seeing the entire class, who had kind of moved away from him when they were scared about learning very recently about his powers that he has. They come back. They decide, like, you know, we're completely confused by what's going on, but we just know that we don't want you to die. So they all stand in the way, and Yuki isn't really able to do too much. He does still continue to attack, and Ogami's arm sets off the Emperor's flame remotely, and it seems as though Ogami is remotely controlling his own arm from being collapsed some distance away. So there's going to be some kind of interplay as to exactly the connection between the power that's hidden within Ogami and within his arm and he himself. Defense Devil, chapter 63 shows initially Kukabara reacting to the potion that was given to him, which isn't poison, but it is poison secretly. So he's okay for now, but then it's being timed so that when he finally rescues Ida Maria and meets up with her again, he's then going to die, is the plan. Ida Maria is shown to be crucified, and this sets up a really bizarre, creative, and just weird scenario. Ida Maria is shown on a cross, strung up on a cross, and colossal, huge statues are moving towards her. And she looks down and realizes that they're all being supported by the unknowns, the human souls that shouldn't be in hell right now. And they're moving the statues at her, and the ones under her, she evidently has some unknowns under her as well, they're pushing her statue cross that she's on into like a spinning fan blade. And ultimately, another statue gets in the way and stops. And so she's confused as all hell. What's going on? She looks up and sees those devils from the past couple chapters, the huge devils with, like, controls. And she looks around and realizes the devils are using these unknowns and her strung up to a cross. She's the ball in a game of statue soccer. That was the most bizarre revelation of anything this week and probably this month. The fact that these devils are playing soccer with souls and trying to get a cross into a spinning blade of fans.
I thought you were incurring on Captain Tsubasa.
Exactly. I'm not exactly sure what to make of that because that's just such a completely off-the-wall concept. I guess you have to give him points for originality, but boy, that's weird. Gintama 320 and 321. Gintama 320, I really wish that it had been translated previous week because clearly that would have been my chapter of the week. We're still trying to protect Satchan at this point from the different assassins that are coming. And the three Punishers have been sent after Satchan, and they are Gintama 320 is one of the funniest chapters of everything of any series that I have ever read, specifically because of the second two Punishers who show up. Punisher number two is T-shirt Tatsu, an assassin who specializes in the deadly art of T-shirts. With ungodly speed, he is able to switch a medium to a small, and he tortures his prey with the fate of eternally wearing a shirt that is too tight. So he's switching off the shirt of Shinpachi into a smaller one, and he ultimately dies because Shinpachi lends him a shirt because he's not wearing a shirt himself, and it's a large, and he can't stand wearing a large, so he dies. And then the Punisher 3 actually ends up being a pair of brothers who specialize in the deadly art of chuperts, which are a Japanese kind of popsicle sort of confectionery. And they're able to take the long end of the chupert and leave their prey with an eternal brother complex because, you know, evidently the older brother would always take the longer end. The younger brother stuck with the shorter end. Really, really hilarious stuff. Conversely, chapter 321 then is a little bit more serious to a point, I will say, because Sat-chan shows up and saves the day because, you know, all these different assassins are about to kill Gintoki and Hattori and Kagura and Shinpachi. She shows up again and crushes the glasses that have been the focal point of this whole chapter and realizes that, you know, the feelings from Gin-san are what counts, not the glasses themselves. So she's given the new glasses, which have been fixed by Gintoki, her old glasses, but he had that famous inventor guy, whose name I forget, I apologize, but he had the famous inventor work on him. And she then starts shooting laser beams out of her eyes and then kind of grows like huge spider legs, and then kind of the glasses form a giant like Valkyrie suit around her. She gets her own little transformation sequence and begins kind of destroying everything around her. So it was serious and heartwarming, and then she turns into a magical girl and kills everything. So rather funny couple of chapters for Gintama there. Katakeshi Hitman Reborn, chapter 304, which is Saint Seiya with kangaroos. It's just the Ryohei versus Aoba fight. Which is actually rather unintelligible because of the art. It's just, again, overly detailed and doesn't make any sense. And Ryohei is just sitting there taking hits forever, and then at the end of it, he seems like he can finally strike back. So it seems like he either has to wait some kind of amount of time before he can strike with his new power-up, or he has to be hit so many times. The most insulting part of this chapter is the fact that the opponents evidently know about what happened to the other characters from Vongola in the future. How do you have memories of what someone else did in the future? I don't exactly understand. And then Nurarihyon no Mago, chapter 120, pardon me. It's not very often you get to see fan service of a fox demon giving birth, but that is what you get on the first page of that chapter. Now, this actually reverts back into more flashback of Abe no Seime and Hagoromo Gitsune, and whereas last chapter we learned that the Abe no Seime character wanted to be perpetually reborn every 1,000 years or so from Hagoromo Gitsune, who seems to be immortal, so that he can maintain the balance between human and yokai. The humans attack Hagoromo Gitsune, some elite, some noble, attacks her and demands that Abe no Seime create a potion of everlasting life out of her liver or something, and so he turns into Nue. This is where he finally becomes the Nue, the feared demon leader that everyone had been referring to all along. And so now he wants to eternally be reborn to kind of cast evil over the world to maintain order in that way. And at the very end, you get to see Nuda kind of set to fight. I don't know his name, but he seems to be the general sort of figure, kind of a very high-ranking militarily role within the Hagoromo Gitsune troops. So we're set now for a Nuda fight. That then concludes this week in manga. It's time now for our chapters of the week. Clint, yours.
My chapter of the week was Naruto 508. I just thought it was an excellent chapter. The way they killed off Kisame was a credit to his character. It was very well done and a bit of intrigue at the end.
And what about you, Drew?
My chapter of the week was Kimi no Iramachi 103. I really like the character growth from Haruto, and I like that we're going to be going back to the town, which hopefully holds its own series of interesting twists, but just the character growth for my chapter of the week.
And ultimately, I have to agree with you on Kimi no Iramachi 103. Unbelievably impressed by that character growth that we talked about and that you just referenced now as your chapter of the week. Really, really thoroughly impressive. After so long of pining over Eva, to be able to make that mature of a statement. Really, really high hopes for the series going forward. Then that concludes the entire show. Thank you so much for listening. Again, please email in questions, comments, requests for the tier list, arguments, etc. shonenbeam@gmail.com. Final Flash.
Kagome is my favorite in Inuyasha.
Troy Polamalu's hair is insured for $1 million, and his play is worth 10 times that.
Omae wa mou, slut. Thank you very much for listening. Good night.